repercussions.
Do you think I should be worried?
Well, that depends what you did.
She's betrayed us.
You haven't betrayed us, have you?
I'll kill you! I'll kill you!
Transcription starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Sunday afternoon at 3.
This is BBC Radio 4.
Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Thursday the 16th of April. This is Today with Justin Webb and Amal Rajan.
The headlines this morning, the BBC has uncovered more abuse of the asylum system, this time with people falsely claiming to be victims of domestic violence to stay in the UK. And the White House says it's discussing a possible second round of peace talks with Iran, describing the negotiations as productive and ongoing.
Also in today's programme, can you name Charlotte Bronte's brother? How about Mozart's sister or Muhammad Ali's younger brother? We celebrate the siblings who didn't quite make the grade. A remarkable new study rewrites human evolution, and sperm whale clicks work like human language. But what are they saying? The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
A BBC investigation has revealed further abuse of the asylum system, with some migrants falsely claiming to be victims of domestic violence in order to stay in the UK. They're exploiting rules brought in to protect genuine victims of abuse to secure a fast-track route to permanent residency. Our politics investigations correspondent Billy Kemba reports.
In an undercover investigation, our reporter posed as a Pakistani migrant to the UK who wanted to leave his British wife, who he was dependent on to stay in the country, to live with his girlfriend. One immigration advisor, Eli Siswaka, said he could make up a story for him that he was the victim of domestic abuse in order to secure leave to remain in the UK. The advisor told our reporter that under special rules for domestic abuse victims, he would then be able to apply for permanent residency without the usual wait. The BBC has also heard concerns from lawyers and people falsely accused of abuse that Home Office checks that accusations are genuine are inadequate. Eli Siswaka denied being willing to make up a story. Jess Phillips, the Home Office Minister, said the abuse of this route was utterly shameful.
The United States says it's holding indirect talks with Iran about resuming peace negotiations in Pakistan. The White House Press Secretary, Caroline Levitt, expressed optimism about the prospect of a deal and said discussions on extending the current 2-week ceasefire were productive and ongoing. A delegation from Pakistan, led by the Chief of the Army, is in Tehran as part of mediation efforts. The BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is also in the Iranian capital and has sent this report on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service, restrictions that apply to all international media organisations operating there.
Airports are still shut, so we entered Iran through a Turkish border crossing in the northwest. Many Iranians were doing the same, returning home, hoping a fragile ceasefire will hold. Around the city of Tabriz, we saw military bases and barracks along the road flattened by airstrikes. But for now, the skies are quiet, and diplomacy intensified in Tehran yesterday. Pakistan's army chief brought proposals, trying to narrow the gaps after last weekend's face-to-face talks, as well as discuss an extension to the temporary truce which expires next week.
President Trump has suggested that the leaders of Israel and Lebanon will speak to each other today for the first time in more than 30 years. In a social media post, Mr. Trump said he was trying to get a little breathing room between the two countries. The governor of the Bank of England has said there will be no rush to raise interest rates, despite the world facing what he described as a very big energy shock. Andrew Bailey told the BBC that higher oil and gas prices would certainly feed through, but other factors made a decision on rates extremely difficult. The Bank of England's rate-setting committee will next meet on the 30th of April. Speaking at the meeting of the International Monetary Fund in Washington, Andrew Bailey said there was a lot of uncertainty.
This is a very big energy shock, and the real determinant here is the duration of it. So I think we're all trying to come to terms with what is, for many parts of the world, a story of, inflation is going to be higher and it is going to have a negative effect on activity. So that's a very, very difficult trade-off to deal with in policy terms.
Government analysis suggests the choice of foodstuffs on supermarket shelves could be restricted if the Strait of Hormuz remains closed until June. Officials have been drawing up contingency plans in case the conflict in the Middle East continues until the summer. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
The closure of the Strait of Hormuz could restrict the supply of CO2, which is widely used in the food industry, including in the slaughtering of pigs and chickens. Sources are stressing that a lack of choice on the shelves is a reasonable worst-case scenario if the conflict continues and coincides with a fall in European CO2 production. A government spokesperson told the BBC that reasonable worst-case scenarios should be seen as planning tools used by experts and were not a prediction of future events.
Local authorities in Ukraine say at least 15 people have been killed by Russian strikes overnight. The mayor of Kyiv says a missile hit a block of flats. In Russia's southern Krasnodar region, the governor says two children, aged 5 and 14, died in a Ukrainian drone attack. Senior executives from Meta, YouTube, TikTok and other social media companies have been summoned to a meeting at Downing Street today. They'll be challenged by Keir Starmer about the action they're taking to protect children. The government is facing increasing pressure to restrict social media use for the under-16s, but last night MPs rejected a second bid from the Lords to bring in an immediate social media ban for young people. Our senior technology reporter Chris Vallance reports.
Number 10 has declined to supply the BBC with the names of the social media company staff attending today's meeting. But whether it's the billionaire tech bosses or more junior representatives, they can expect a stern talking to. The Prime Minister is expected to tell the tech firms they need to step up and take responsibility for protecting children, and that looking the other way is not an option. Today's meeting comes after the government revealed a consultation on Australian-style restrictions on social media use for under-16s has so far attracted 45,000 responses.
An influential review of existing studies has concluded that Alzheimer's drugs that were heralded as a major breakthrough are unlikely to benefit patients. The Cochrane collaboration looked at 17 studies of drugs and concluded that their impact was well below the level needed to make a difference. But some scientists say the research was fundamentally flawed, as old experimental drugs were lumped together with new ones that work.
Thank you very much indeed, Jane. It is 6 minutes past six. Time to say good morning to Chris Fawkes, who's got the weather. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning, Amal. Well, today we've got quite a changeable kind of weather day with cloud and drizzle to start off with. Then it brightens up with a bit of sunshine. More cloud and drizzle, though, to end the day across the west. So things changing hour by hour, really. Now, for England and Wales, it is a pretty cloudy start to the day. We've got some drizzle, particularly affecting parts of northern England, Wales in the southwest of England too. An odd patch for the Midlands and southeast England. Across parts of Lincolnshire and East Anglia should be a bright start to the day with some early morning sunshine. As we go through the morning, I think for many areas the clouds will tend to thin and break with some sunny spells coming through. But later in the afternoon, a cloud will re-thicken across Wales, southern counties of England, probably the Midlands too, bringing with it a few patches of drizzle to end the day, leaving the best of any brighter weather across northern England, Lincolnshire and parts of Norfolk as well. Temperature-wise, we're looking at highs 15 to 17 Celsius, so it should feel quite pleasant in any brighter moments. Now, for Northern Ireland, should be a bright start to the day with spells of sunshine. Here, it clouds over through the afternoon with rain and drizzle developing, a stiffening southerly wind as well this afternoon. Temperatures 12 to 14 degrees here. And for Scotland, we start off cloudy with outbreaks of rain for many areas. That will tend to clear away with some sunshine following on for a time this afternoon. The end of the day, though, sees cloud thicken across the southwest of Scotland with a bit of drizzle returning here. Our temperatures today around 12 to 15 Celsius. Overnight sees cloud and rain spread to northern and western areas. And we've got some rain pushing eastwards across the UK tomorrow. Not much for eastern England. The rain followed by sunshine and showers in the north and west. That's the latest.
Well, Chris, thank you. 8 minutes past six. Let's have our first look at the papers. The Times reporting that during a rehearsal codenamed Exercise Turnstone, government officials found that the UK farming and hospitality sectors would be hit earliest and hardest by any shortage of carbon dioxide caused by the continuing closure of the Strait of Hormuz and other problems as well with gas production. The paper says CO2 is used in slaughtering nearly all pigs and more than two-thirds of chickens, and the farming sector is not thought to have much by way of surplus supplies.
The Daily Telegraph leads on a forecast by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, that taxes in the UK are set to rise the fastest out of any of the G7 nations. It says the tax burden as a proportion of GDP will be more than 40%, a peacetime high. as the paper puts it, at the start of the next decade.
The Financial Times reports that Iran has acquired a Chinese-built spy satellite, which it's allegedly using to monitor US bases in the Middle East. The paper says that with Tehran targeting its Gulf neighbours who sell oil to China, the matter is sensitive. Beijing's foreign ministry tells the FT the report is untrue.
The Guardian carries an analysis of oil and gas companies' profits, reporting that the world's top 100 firms had what the paper calls a war windfall in March, totalling $23 billion.
Hundreds of public bodies are, according to the Daily Mail, yet to update their policies on single-sex spaces, despite the Supreme Court's landmark judgment on biological sex a year ago. The paper's headline is Labour's shameful betrayal of women. A government spokesperson says it's always supported the protection of single-sex spaces based on biological sex.
Several of the back pages report that LIV Golf is in jeopardy with the tour's Saudi backers set to pull their funding. The Telegraph says senior executives have been summoned to an emergency meeting in Manhattan.
And The Sun reports that the Transport Secretary's Mini Cooper had to be towed away after hitting a pothole. Heidi Alexander tells the paper the car blew two tyres thanks to a crater worthy of the moon on a road near Burford in Oxfordshire. She acknowledges the resulting expense and inconvenience, adding it was the experience of far too many people in the country at the moment.
The time now is 10 minutes past six.
Governor of the Bank of England is in Washington for the annual IMF Jamboree, has been talking to our economics editor Faisal Islam about what will happen to interest rates. I asked Faisal what he'd said.
He said that the world faces a very big energy shock, and in particular, he was keen to sort of clarify that he wasn't going to sort of rush to judgments on interest rate rises. Yesterday, the managing director of the IMF sort of pointed out that whatever you couldn't predict about the future from what was happening in the Straits of Hormuz, it was important that central banks, you know, didn't exacerbate the issue, and that there shouldn't be a sort of rush to raise interest rates at the same time, given the uncertainty.
I mean, it's interesting, though, isn't it? He is in a real bind, to put it bluntly, isn't he? As are other central bankers, but he is in a real bind.
Yes, and there's all the uncertainty about what's happening in terms of the underlying issue in the Strait. But on top of that, they clearly don't want to exacerbate any weakness in the economy. But at the same time, this is obviously adding to inflation. So the advice from the IMF, as I mentioned, was, you know, just wait and see and see how things develop. And the US administration is telling the world here at this meeting that they do hope that this situation kind of resolves within weeks rather than months.
But that's an interesting one. So, Faisal, is he suggesting then that if it is resolved, in spite of the damage that has been done, when you think of the supplies of energy, of oil and gas around the world, that actually, did you get the impression then that interest rates sort of stay as they are into the medium term?
Clearly, it's a decision for a committee of nine, and the next meeting is within the next couple of weeks. There is concern, and I think we heard this not just from the governor yesterday, here from finance ministers, from central bankers, from the likes of the IMF, that even if everything ended in terms of hostilities tomorrow, which they won't, you still have weeks to months of disruption. And whatever happens in terms of the peace talks, there are concerns that can't be avoided. Clearly, it could get worse if this carries on, though.
Faisal Islam in Washington. Thank you.
13 minutes past six, front page of story of the Times this morning. UK facing summer of shortages on shelves. Lack of CO2 to hit farming if Strait stays shut. This is specifically about food shortages. And John Sudworth is here to tell us a bit more. It's quite an alarming headline, John. How bad could this be?
It is. I mean, I think the government will probably want to put a couple of caveats on that headline. I think what they will say they're talking about here is a possible lack of a variety of some foods rather than across the board shortages. This planning exercise Turnstone, they're calling it, is for a reasonable worst case scenario. So the kind of things built into this modelling, first of all, the assumption that the Strait of Hormuz will still be closed this summer. Obviously, everybody will be hoping that is not the case. And a couple of other things about other disruptions. So they're really looking at how at the worst possible scenario. And in this scenario, it is chicken and pork that will be affected. There is a potential for some shortages. And if nothing else, it shows again, Amal, those real risks right across supply chains in places that you wouldn't have thought necessarily would flow from a war in Iran.
Why chicken and pork?
Well, it just shows again the complexity of these supply chains. Chicken and pork because we all know that natural gas is now being held up in the Strait of Hormuz.
Right.
Natural gas is used for the production of fertilizer. That's now being stalled. One of the byproducts of fertilizer is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is used in slaughterhouses for killing chickens and pigs, essentially. It's one of the main methods by which they are suffocated. So, flowing from that disruption to the supply of hydrocarbons, you get all of these, unintended consequences. And one interesting thing, as part of this exercise Turnstone, looking for potential mitigations, the government has announced that it is reopening a bioethanol plant up in Teesside, essentially a bioethanol plant that was mothballed because of the Trump tariff negotiations last year. They led to an increase in supply of bioethanol from the US, something America was pushing for very strongly. That made production at this plant apparently unviable. So it's no small irony that here we are a year later, and it is Trump's war in Iran that has got that plant reopened.
Fascinating, fascinating. It does show the interconnectedness of these supply chains. John Sudworth, always good to see you. Thank you.
16 minutes past six is the time. All businesses have been promised help with their energy bills, but maybe not enough, and maybe not enough of them as well. Sean has that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Sean.
They're the key questions, aren't they? So now it's more than 10,000 manufacturing businesses that are going to be eligible for the British Industrial Competitiveness Scheme. We've talked about it before because we have initially seen 7,000 businesses eligible, but now the government's increasing that number by knocking off these levies on certain bills for certain manufacturers that could mean their electricity bills are cut by up to 25% from April next year. Sharon Lane is Managing Director of Tees Components. Sharon, morning. Just first, give us a sense of your size of the business and where your manufacturing business would sit amongst all of those across the country.
Yeah, morning. So Tees Components, we're based in Redcar and Cleveland in the northeast. We employ around 55 people, turnover about 5.5 million. And we use a lot of energy because we have a large machining facility and we're operating a lot of CNC machine tools and other equipment that use a lot of power.
So is this going to improve things for businesses like yours around the country?
Well, we don't know yet because having had a look at the news that's come out, it's not really clear which manufacturers will benefit from this. It depends on your SIC codes, which are the codes for the activity that you're carrying out, which are an incredibly blunt tool that, you know, just desperately needs review anyway. And your HS codes, which is the Harmonized System Commodity Code, which is what you're actually making. And then the proportion of the electricity that you use that is actually specifically being used for those products.
So
have you, I have no idea.
Right. Well, good luck getting that detail, I guess, then. Have you had a sense, you know, since this scheme was announced, you know, from those that you have come across that have been eligible for it, has it changed an outlook for those businesses and actually materially made a difference?
Since it was announced last year with the industrial strategy, I think because there's just still a bit of a lack of detail about who will benefit, there hasn't really been certainty from any manufacturers I've spoken to that this is going to improve things. I mean, if you are eligible, it's great because it's about a 25% cut in your energy bill by making you exempt from these other indirect costs. And that would certainly be very welcome. But I think the rollout now is expected to be about 10,000 manufacturers.
Yeah.
We have something like just under 100,000 manufacturers in the UK. So it's helpful, but it's not going to help. And I think particularly those in the supply chain who are, you know, carrying out processes on these parts that are energy intensive but I'm guessing wouldn't be eligible because they're not technically manufacturing the whole part, if that makes sense. So you've got, you know, steel processors, fabricators, machinists like us, heat treatment, coatings. You know, I wouldn't have expected all of those businesses to be eligible, and they're the ones that need help as well.
Just finally then, Sharon, what is the state of play for you at the moment then? I mean, you don't know about this scheme yet, and there's clearly tens of thousands of manufacturers who won't be included in it. So what's on the cards for you with energy prices at the moment?
Well, the thing with the energy prices is, of course, it's been so volatile, and the impact on business has really depended on when you happen to have come out of your contract. And we were really lucky that in 2022, we weren't due to come out of contract. And then similarly, now we're not either. So our actual price isn't too horrendous. And then we've invested in on-site renewable energy with a lot of PV, and we've brought down our energy use. Our solar panels.
Right.
So we've brought down our power that we use per hour that we work by around 30% in the last 4 years.
Gotcha.
By energy efficiency and more renewable energy.
Sharon, thank you very much. Sharon Lane, Managing Director of Tees Components there. There's been a big deal done by the FTSE 100 Pension and Savings Group, Standard Life, formerly known as Phoenix Group. It struck a £2 billion deal to buy the UK arm of Aegon. So this transaction will take Standard Life's customer base to 16 million, will create what's said to be the UK's biggest retirement savings and income business, so second in workplace pensions it'll be, second in more general retail pensions and savings as well. Standard Life's chief executive is Andy Briggs. Andy, good morning. What's the plan here?
Good morning, Sean. No, so we're very excited. It accelerates our vision to be the UK's leading retirement savings and income business. As you say, it makes us the market leader by far. We'll have nearly half a trillion of assets. But it's also highly complementary. So it strengthens our capability and customer offer, which means we're not only bigger, we'll also be better and better able to meet the needs of our 16 million customers.
Well, so there is some of the benefits for Standard Life, but it does sound like for customers out there who might be looking across the market for, you know, businesses like yours to fight to persuade them to put their retirement cash with you, there's one less big investment business out there. There's less competition for customers.
Yeah, but there's still plenty of competition. Our share of the total market is maybe about 15% now, so there's still plenty of competition. The market is very spread. But what's particularly attractive for our customers is we have a broader range of products and solutions for them. So, for example, Aegon UK has a significant advice business, which then means we can offer the Standard Life customers much more advice as well as they journey to and through retirement.
Does this mean job cuts?
So we will be making savings as we bring these businesses together. That is likely to lead to some level of job cuts, but relatively modest, certainly compared to other deals that you've seen. And then we always
Modest then? Because we're talking sort of 7,000 or 8,000 staff overall. How much would you be expected that headcount to be reduced by proportionally?
So we haven't put a specific number on that. The combined cost base of the two businesses together is about £1.4 billion, and the cost savings are about £100 million. So relatively modest. What we also do, Sean, when we do M&A is we share some of the benefits of the cost savings with our customers in the form of lower charges.
I just wonder for Edinburgh in particular, where a lot of the staff from, you know, both of these parts of the business are based, it's not the best news.
I'd say it's exciting for Edinburgh because we're creating a UK retirement champion here with Standard Life, bringing the two businesses together, and Edinburgh will be by far our biggest centre. So I think it's exciting, and we're ambitious to grow the business going forward. People in the UK are not saving enough for retirement. Only 1 in 7 are saving enough. So we want to be growing our business to help more people make better provision for their retirement.
Tell me a bit more about that, not saving enough for retirement, because you will have done the analysis on many, many more customers. Where are the biggest concerns about people not saving enough, given we've had auto enrolment and workplace pensions in place for a long time now?
So the biggest challenge is that in the UK, the auto enrolment minimum contribution rates are 8%. And customers then think, well, if that's the minimum rate that's set, then that's enough for a decent retirement. And the honest answer is it isn't. So only one in seven are saving enough. Just to give you a sense of this, Sean, in Canada, people are saving on average 20% of their salary each year into pensions compared to the UK's 8%. Within the UK, of that 8%, the employer is paying 3% of that. In Australia, they're just moving the employer contribution to 12%. So the government has set up a pensions commission, independent pensions commission, to look at this. We're delighted about that because we are very concerned that people feel if they're doing that minimum rate, they're doing enough, and in reality, they're not.
Andy, what does that do for the economy? Because you also will be sort of needing, you know, confidence in an economy, and you'll be investing in businesses, and so we'll, you know, need them to be performing well. When people hear that change in numbers, that it may be that people need to put more aside for retirements, so that means less spend now. Businesses might need to contribute more to that now instead of being able to invest elsewhere. Could that be quite a drastic hit to the economy?
So that definitely needs to be managed very, very carefully, Sean. So we have our own think tank, the Standard Life Centre for the Future of Retirement, who does sort of independent research. And what they concluded is that the minimum rate needs to move from 8% to 12%, but it needs to happen gradually over time. So perhaps, say, a 1% increase per annum, so that it makes it more affordable for both employers and consumers.
Andy Briggs, Chief Executive of Standard Life, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Sean.
French joins us now from Panmure Liberum. Simon, very good morning
good
to
morning,
you.
Good morning, Sean.
Simon, we continue. I mean, we've heard Faisal's interview with Andrew Bailey and the prospects for interest rates and all that. There's more coming out of Washington about the International Monetary Fund's analysis of countries around the world. Tax getting a lot of headlines this morning. So the tax burden, as we would often call it in the UK, growing faster than many other equivalent economies. Yet the IMF saying our finances might be in a better situation. How do you view it?
Both things are true. The increase in the tax rate is part of what is current government policy to reduce the size of the deficit, currently running at about £140 billion on a year, down to a lower level close to half that. Now, that is in sharp contrast, and it's why the IMF have made these comments, to pretty much every other major G7 economy for whom deficit reduction on that scale is not happening. But the side effect of that is what is already a tax burden on the UK economy that is at an 80-year high is expected to go even higher as a proportion of GDP. Now, that doesn't make the UK an international outlier, but it certainly makes it an outlier versus any lived experience of almost all listeners in their lifetime.
And just on the investment reaction to Andrew Bailey's words to Faisal about not rushing interest rate rises, does that change your expectations a little bit now?
No, it doesn't. And actually, the comments from the governor really was to what we call in the city talking down the curve, because the market, the pricing of interest rate swaps had assumed 3 to 4 interest rate increases. Now, economists, the sort of the humans behind all this, never saw that. And I think the Andrew Bailey's comments were, I think the economists got it better than market pricing. I think a wait and see approach on UK interest rates is far more likely than a knee-jerk reaction, because there's just simply so much uncertainty out there.
Economist says economists got it right. thank you for that, Simon. Simon French from Panmure Liberum. I'll leave you with the news that the Brent crude barrel of oil is just below $95 a barrel this morning.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. It is 27 minutes past six and time to say good morning to the great Mike Williams, who's got the sport.
You're too kind. Thank you, Amal. Good morning. For the second season in a row, Arsenal are through to the semi-finals of the Champions League, despite a lacklustre display in their quarter-final second leg with Sporting Lisbon last night. It finished 0-0 on the night, meaning Arsenal progress 1-0 on aggregate. John Murray reports.
It wasn't particularly pretty, but it was effective, and Arsenal remain unbeaten in the Champions League this season and are semi-finalists for a second year in a row. Sporting, the champions of Portugal, proved themselves a capable team, but couldn't find a way past David Raya in the Arsenal goal in the 180 minutes plus of the tie. The closest they came here was a Catamo shot that struck the face of a post and a late effort just wide by substitute Simoes. Arsenal didn't dazzle and created little themselves, bar an unlikely header against a post from Trossard, and went through thanks to Havertz's goal in Lisbon. But they've conceded only 5 goals in 12 Champions League matches this season. And in the semi-finals, it's Atletico Madrid, who Arsenal beat 4-0 in the league phase in October.
Let's hear then, shall we, from the Arsenal manager Mikel Arteta, who suggests at this stage of the season, results are more important than performances.
You have to be better than the opponent, and I think we have many periods in the game that we were there. We didn't score the goal, we didn't finalise the actions well enough. But we had many other things that are very important to get the result that you need in a tie. And it's at this moment as well about the way you compete to go and win titles. That's when it's going to define the moments, and we certainly done that tonight.
Elsewhere, remarkable game in Germany last night saw Bayern Munich emerge victorious from a 7-goal thriller against 15-time European champions Real Madrid, winning 4-3 on the night, 6-4 on aggregate. Harry Kane scored his 50th goal of the season.
Yeah, whenever you beat a team like Real Madrid, especially in like the later stages of the Champions League, of course it will give you confidence. But we spoke about it all year, about getting to this stage, being in all the competitions, and this is the time to really push on. We feel like we can beat anyone when we're at our highest level, and again, we're going to need that in the next round, because PSG are one of the best teams in Europe for sure. So it's time to enjoy this. We have a chance to win the league on the weekend. Hopefully we can manage that, and then we have a big semi-final in the cup. So plenty of big games, big moments left in the season, and we need to be ready for that.
That was Harry Kane talking to CBS last night. So Bayern will now face the defending champions Paris Saint-Germain in the semi-finals. Away from football, three-time Olympic champion Adam Peaty continued his fine form last night by winning the 50 metres breaststroke at the Aquatics GB Swimming Championships in London. And let's leave the final word of the Sport Bulletin, shall we, to Jamie Murray, who you may have seen retired from tennis yesterday after a stellar 25-year career. The 40-year-old is a 7-time Grand Slam champion and became the first British doubles player to rise to world number one.
I think getting to number one in the world is basically the peak of the sport, right? Like, that's what, you know, all kids dream of, and, you know, so few are able to do it, really. And also, I mean, coming from Dunblane and Scotland, where there's no history of tennis, there's no environment for tennis, I would imagine, like, the odds were against us, like, from the start. But, you know, we're able to make some good things happen, I think.
Truly the end of an era for British tennis. Both Murray brothers now retired from the sport.
Mike, thank you for that. Next week on Radio 4, Jim Al-Khalili begins a brand new series.
There are more atoms in a single glass of water than there are glasses of water in all the oceans of the Earth.
Language that can bring the invisible world of atoms to life.
It invites us to have this very intimate connection with the natural world that we do know, and from there to get to the underlying natural world that we can't see.
In a new series for Radio 4, I'll trace the history of our attempt to understand these tiny, fundamental building blocks that make up the world around us. Writing the Atom with me, Jim Al-Khalili, starts Monday morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Well, the time is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Amol Rajan. Here is a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
A BBC investigation has uncovered further misuse of the asylum system, with some migrants falsely claiming to be victims of domestic abuse in an attempt to remain in the UK. It found that protections designed to support genuine victims are being exploited to access a fast-track route to permanent residency. The United States has confirmed that it's discussing a possible second round of peace talks with Iran in Pakistan. The White House press secretary expressed optimism about the prospect of a deal and said they were also discussing an extension of the current ceasefire before it ends next week. President Trump has suggested that the leaders of Israel and Lebanon will speak to each other today for the first time in more than 30 years. In a social media post, Mr. Trump said he was trying to get a little breathing room between the two countries. Ukraine says at least 14 people have been killed and dozens injured in overnight Russian missile and drone attacks across the country. 7 people were killed in the southern port of Odessa. 5 died in missile strikes on the capital, Kiev, including a 12-year-old child. The governor of the Bank of England has said there will be no rush to raise interest rates, despite the world facing what he described as a very big energy shock. Andrew Bailey told the BBC that higher oil and gas prices would certainly feed through, but other factors made a decision on rates extremely difficult. Social media bosses are being summoned to Downing Street today to discuss children's safety online with the Prime Minister. Top executives from Meta, YouTube, TikTok and X are expected to be questioned by Sir Keir Starmer and the Technology Secretary Liz Kendall on what they're doing to protect children and respond to parental concerns. An influential review of existing studies has concluded that Alzheimer's drugs that were heralded as a major breakthrough are unlikely to benefit patients. However, the research by the Cochrane collaboration has provoked arguments, with some scientists labelling it as fundamentally flawed.
Jane, thank you for that. Just coming up to 25 to 7, as we were hearing in the news, Donald Trump has suggested on Truth Social overnight that progress is being made in bringing Israel and Lebanon together for direct talks. I've been hearing more from our correspondent, Peter Bowes.
Donald Trump has posted quite briefly on Truth Social. I'll just read you what it says. It says, trying to get a little breathing room between Israel and Lebanon. It has been a long time since the two leaders have spoken, like 34 years. It will happen tomorrow, presumably meaning today, Thursday. Nice, says the president. Now, he doesn't specify exactly which leaders he is referring to, but presumably referring to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Lebanese leader Joseph Aoun. And of course, this is significant because of the talks that were held just earlier this week in Washington that were historic in themselves. The last time that there were trilateral talks hosted of this nature involving Israel and Lebanon was 1993.
And it's also significant, isn't it? Because one of the things Iran has been saying is that there needs to be a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah in order that they themselves agree to a longer term peace deal. And it seems now, does it, that this is a jigsaw piece being put into place, at least in the view of the White House, that might make the Iran talks that they're trying to hold easier.
This will certainly raise hopes of a ceasefire between Hezbollah and Israel, which the US would very much like to see, essentially, as they would see it in the White House, preventing a wider regional war, especially along the Israel-Lebanon border, but also potentially jeopardizing the ceasefire, the current ceasefire that we've been talking about between the United States and Iran. This is a vast jigsaw, as you frame it, but this could be a very important piece if it is put into place.
And it's worth saying, isn't it, briefly, that the White House, before Donald Trump was on Truth Social and talking about Lebanon, the White House was already talking up the prospects of a deal being done.
Yes, I think the mood music is quite positive, talking about diplomacy continuing, although there are no immediate signs that any new face-to-face talks are going to be taking place of a similar nature to the ones that we saw the past weekend. But I think what they are saying is that behind the scenes they are continuing to talk. I don't think we're going to see negotiations in 2 days' time, as Donald Trump predicted earlier this week. But it looks like behind the scenes, they are moving in the same direction. And the press secretary, Caroline Levitt, said once again that the White House feels good about the prospect of a deal. And she reiterated that the U.S. red lines were well known, that Donald Trump has talked about, that J.D. Vance has talked about this past week. And she said that it was in Iran's interest to meet their demands.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
It's 23 minutes to 7. MPs have rejected an attempt by the House of Lords to ban under-16s from social media platforms. And this is beginning to open up a quite interesting political divide within Westminster. Henry Zeffman is our chief political correspondent. Henry, morning. Of course, the Lords can do this. They can say thank you, thanks, but no thanks. But where is the Commons now on this idea that this sort of sense that that public sentiment and political sentiment is hardening towards the kind of position that Australia's got?
It definitely is hardening in that direction, Amol. I mean, it's the second time in 2 months that the House of Commons, by which I really mean Labour MPs, have overturned a ban voted for by the House of Lords. So the vote yesterday was essentially Labour and a few others versus the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats and a few others. Now, crucially, the argument the government makes for overturning the ban that's been voted for by the House of Lords is that they are looking at this question themselves in a consultation which began in March and is running through to mid-May and will give an answer pretty shortly after that, and therefore a vote in the House of Commons is premature. And you mentioned how the political climate on this is changing. It really is one of those issues where it is staggering how fast the political climate has shifted. As a journalist, you can kind of feel the gust of wind as politicians race to catch up with how the public mood has changed. The widespread assumption still among MPs, actually MPs on different sides of this argument who I've spoken to about this, the conventional wisdom is that the government will either propose a ban or something quite close to it when they do respond to that public consultation. Even Keir Starmer this week, speaking to BBC Radio 5 Live, was talking about the addictive scrolling mechanisms in social media. So I expect we will hear much more about this before very long.
And what of the reaction in Westminster yesterday to our, well, to Billy Kemba's reporting on this programme at 7:30 yesterday about the way in which asylum seekers are able to use, frankly, rather shady individuals to sort of basically come up with fraudulent claims?
Yeah, that investigation by Billy Kemba and Phil Kemp had a huge impact in Westminster yesterday. Some people shocked, others saying they were not so surprised, but all of them, I think, aghast at what was revealed in quite such vivid detail. I mean, it speaks volumes that Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, felt she had to respond. She said, "Let me be clear, if you try to defraud the British people to enter or remain in the UK, you will find yourself on a one-way flight out of Britain." Now, people in government are saying they were aware of some of this cheating. They say a change in the law is coming next week, which will make it easier to withdraw support from claimants who can be proved to be fraudulent. They're also, interestingly, not ruling out closing down visa routes where it is clear a disproportionate number later go on to claim asylum fraudulently. Right. I think that's one to watch. And then all the other parties also expressing concern in various stark language about this.
Henry, thank you very much indeed. Plenty more of Billy Kemba's reporting after 7 o'clock.
Let us at 7:20 turn, though, to the COVID inquiry, because it gives its verdict today on how vaccinations and drug treatments were rolled out during the pandemic. Let's talk to Jim Reid, our health correspondent, who's been following the COVID inquiry through every twist and turn. Jim, what are we expecting today?
So this is the fourth report, Justin, of 10 in total, which the inquiry will publish due around midday, based on 3 weeks of hearings taken last year, looking, as you say, at the vaccine rollout and the drugs used to treat COVID. On the surface, this is, I think, the one section of pandemic response which is widely considered to probably be most successful. A vaccine task force was set up by now Dame Kate Bingham, a biotech executive. She gave evidence to say that actually when she was given the job, she was told the chances of success with these vaccines was very low. So the authorities had to essentially place spread bets and fund the development of different vaccines to see which ones might work. Then there was the rollout itself. Over 90% of people in the UK had at least one dose of a vaccine. But in certain pockets of the population, that rate was much lower. That's an area I think the inquiry will look at today. And then there were other policies that were more contentious. You might remember at one point the government made it mandatory for some healthcare staff to be vaccinated, then had to U-turn very quickly on that. That's another area we're expecting the inquiry today to focus on, as is the support for people who were harmed by the vaccine, particularly blood clots linked to the Oxford AstraZeneca jab. Now, those cases were rare, about 20,000 applications so far to the government's vaccine damage payment scheme about COVID vaccines, but based on 184 million doses given. The families involved believe the risks, though, could have been recognised and communicated earlier, and they've criticised the current system of financial support. And that's, again, something we expect the inquiry to look into in detail at midday today when this report is published.
And how does this then fit into the wider report, the full report?
Well, as I say, this is the fourth section to report back. We've had three reports so far looking at pandemic planning, political decision making and the effect on the NHS. We'll have another three or four due before the end of the year, looking at different aspects of the pandemic. Much criticism about the time this has taken and the cost, over £200 million so far. That's something the chair, Baroness Hallett, did address actually earlier this year. She did accept this has taken a lot of time and a lot of money, but said she believes genuinely it has been worth it.
Jim Reid, thank you.
Well, Iran dominated PMQs yesterday, so Keir Starmer said he would not yield to pressure to change his stance on the Iran war. He told MPs at Prime Minister's Questions that pressure included President Trump's threat that he might scrap the UK's trade deal with the US. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Susan Hume.
Downing Street will have learned not to celebrate too soon when the UK clinches any kind of deal with President Trump, because just a casual chat with a journalist can send it all spinning.
In a phone call with Sky News last night, President Trump has threatened to rip up his trade deal with the UK as punishment for us not joining his idiotic war in Iran.
The Lib Dem leader, Sir Ed Davey, is up to here with it all.
This must be the last straw. Surely the Prime Minister can't send our king to meet a man who treats our country like a mafia boss running a protection racket.
Over this turbulent year or so, the Prime Minister has been careful to avoid criticising President Trump. But more recently, and mentioning no names, Sir Keir Starmer has pushed back harder. He said his position on the Iran war had been clear from the start.
We're not going to get dragged into this war. It is not our war. And a lot of pressure has been applied to me to take a different course. And that pressure included what happened last night. I'm not going to change my mind. I'm not going to yield. It is not in our national interest to join this war, and we will not do so. I know where I stand.
As for the King's visit to the United States,
the monarchy is an important reminder of the long-standing bonds and enduring relationship between our two countries, which are far greater than anyone who occupies any particular office at any particular time. Yeah.
But this week, Keir Starmer has had to endure an attack from another ally too. The Labour peer Lord Robertson, a former NATO Secretary General and architect of Labour's defence plan, is highly fed up that the government has still not revealed the funding for that rearmament. And he said so bluntly, words quoted with zeal by the Conservative leader.
Lord Robertson, who authored the government's strategic defence review, has said the Prime Minister has a corrosive complacency when it comes to defence. Why did he say that?
Mr Speaker, let me start by saying I respect Lord Robertson. And I thank him again. I thank him again for carrying out the strategic review. My responsibility is to keep the British people safe, and that is a duty I take seriously. That is why I don't agree with his comments.
But he said he'd already made difficult decisions in order to commit to spending on defence. But the Prime Minister was, for another week, especially keen to talk about Kemi Badenoch and her initial support for the UK getting involved with the US in Iran, till the Speaker pulled him up on it. Kemi Badenoch said he loved to misrepresent her. And she reminded him he'd turned down her offer to help him cut welfare to pay for defence. She reckoned Lord Robertson was on her wavelength.
Now that Lord Robertson has said, and I quote, "We cannot defend Britain with an ever-expanding welfare budget," will the Prime Minister think again and work with us to find savings to fund defence?
The Prime Minister ignored that to begin with and kept hammering away with his characterisation of Kemi Badenoch's approach to the Iran war.
She said we should give verbal support. I suppose that's standing on the side and saying, "Get in there, good luck, mate, you've got this."
As for welfare, the last Conservative government had seen it soar.
So taking advice from the party opposite on reforming welfare and defence spending is like asking Liz Truss how to keep your mortgage down.
This is so poor from the Prime Minister. This is... Labour MPs are laughing. Labour MPs are laughing, Mr Speaker.
Actually, lots of MPs were soon chortling at a saucy reference to a sex education campaign by Labour's Samantha Niblett.
This is a moment of profound national seriousness. And what are they doing? They're promoting sex toys in Parliament. That's what they're doing. Mr Speaker, it gives a whole new meaning to fiddling while Rome burns.
The Prime Minister wisely left that to one side. As for national seriousness,
she said a few weeks ago that serious times call for serious people. She is not one of them.
The Prime Minister remaining serious there.
That was Susan Hume reporting on yesterday in Parliament. It's 13 minutes to seven. Well, staying with Iran, let's look now at what impact the economic sanctions and this blockade are having on that country, and specifically whether or not they're going to end up hurting the Iranian people, but paradoxically strengthening the Iranian regime. A short time ago, I spoke to Miad Maliki. He's a former senior US Treasury official who's currently senior advisor at the think tank Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
You know, Iran is subject to the most comprehensive U.S. economic sanctions regime that has ever been imposed on any other countries. You also have the United Nations sanctions. You have the European Union sanctions. You also have UK's sanctions regime. US economic sanctions are usually the most biting and impactful. And the reason for that is really the nature of Iran's economy, which is a really fossil fuel economy. And what that means is that when your economy is tied to the fossil fuel, you're doing large business transactions. You can't avoid US dollar accounts, US dollar transactions, and US financial institutions. So for that reason, really, Iran's economy has been really under really significant pressure.
And it's particularly striking, isn't it, that the restriction on bank accounts is the manner in which people are trying to hurt Iran. Why is that an effective way of imposing restrictions on their regime?
It blocks the regime's ability to repatriate revenue that it generates from the sale of commodities, whether it's crude oil, petrochemicals, natural gas, and also other aspects of Iran's exports, such as metals and even pistachios or other agricultural commodities that Iran exports. And when they can't repatriate the revenue, then their hands become very tied when it comes to importing their essential goods.
Right. And is there a danger, do you think, though, that you end up hurting the Iranian people, but not the Iranian regime? They are separate things. Not all the Iranian people support the Iranian regime. Is there a danger that actually you end up just hurting the millions of people to whom Donald Trump said a few months ago, help is coming?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the really sad part of the situation in Iran or any other country that you're having a crisis. You know, in the case of Iran, the reality is these are the decisions that is Islamic Republic, the Islamic regime has made since 1979 to pick a fight with the international community, to export its revolution, to act as a revolutionary regime as opposed to a government that puts its country's national interest as a priority. So, you know, it had to have a nuclear program that has been really not economically never made sense because it's cheaper to buy enriched uranium if you want to have a nuclear program to provide energy. They are testing intercontinental ballistic missiles that are potentially capable of carrying a nuclear weapon. They actually, in fact, did have a secret nuclear weapon program. They're also at the same time threatening their neighbors and the West and the Europe with their proxies and surrogate groups. They've been causing a lot of problem. And unfortunately, the main victim of these type of activities by this regime are the Iranian people.
And do you think the blockade is proving successful in achieving the aims that the U.S. specifically has?
What the blockade is doing is, as opposed to where we were when Iran was blocking the Strait of Hormuz, when Iran was selectively allowing some of its own tankers to go through, now the blockade has changed that, and it's really blocking Iran from exporting its oil, petrochemicals, and metals, and also blocking Iran from importing about $127 million a day goods.
And what other levers do you think the U.S. can and should pull?
Well, at this point, you're going to really cut off their access to $275 million a day of export, the revenue that could generate, and as I said, the import that comes through. What can be targeted now to really increase pressure on this regime, if that's the intent, it continues to stay the intent of U.S. government, absence any kind of a deal or agreement, then it would be putting pressure on the banks in the region where Iran has frozen assets or restricted funds or blocked funds. And that's the type of relief that the regime really needs right now. And they have been asking the U.S. and the regional countries to release those funds. So if you really want to put more pressure on them, you got to really make sure the banks in the region and in China, they're not really giving in to Iranian pressure to release any of those funds.
Miad Maliki in Washington, D.C., thank you so much for joining us. It's now 7:08. 1 in 10 online pharmacies in the UK have had their websites and social media presence cloned. That's according to a survey by the National Pharmacy Association. It's leading to the growing phenomenon of customers complaining to pharmacists about drugs that were never actually sold to them. Why is this happening and what should be done about it? Well, Sihar Shahid is a pharmacist who's on the board of the National Pharmacy Association and whose website and social media accounts were themselves cloned. Sihar, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. We'll come to your experience in just a moment, but just take us through what you've actually found. What is the this slightly alarming new phenomenon? What's happening?
So through the survey that the National Pharmacy Association did, we found that 1 in 10 online pharmacies have had their websites and social media accounts cloned by criminals. And it's really put a lot of patients at risk. What the results from this survey has showed is that it's actually more widespread than we thought. It's not just online pharmacies, but even community pharmacies, bricks and mortar pharmacies have also had their brand and their company name also cloned, and patients have been, misinformed and, kind of lured into purchasing from illegal, unregulated companies posing to be a regulated pharmacy as well. So it is very alarming.
And to be clear, this is the people who are making these purchases. They're going to websites where they might pay money, they'll lose some of their data, and they're often going after prescriptions which aren't just sort of, run-of-the-mill antibiotics. This will be high-risk prescriptions as well.
Yeah, of course. So these patients are vulnerable. They are obviously going to websites or social media accounts thinking that, they are a trusted regulated pharmacy, because these criminals are using brands and they're kind of jumping on the brand and the trust of other regulated pharmacies. And then they're going and they're usually what we're seeing is it's weight loss medication that patients are then purchasing. Now, there's a huge amount of risk within that because, one, we don't even know if it's genuine medication. Most likely it's counterfeit. So that poses a huge risk to patients' health because they don't know what substance they're putting into their body. Secondly, because obviously it's not a regulated provider, they aren't medically trained. So they are issuing, even if it is, a genuine medication and they've managed to source some of that and they're trying to sell it, it's not being given to patients after a consultation to make sure it's clinically appropriate.
Right. What happened to you?
So we had reports from other pharmacies that got in touch with us and said, by the way, do you know that all your TikTok videos are being cloned and there's several accounts that are using your brand, your logo, your pharmacy name, but slightly different, but at first glance it looks exactly like us. And when I looked onto those TikTok accounts, all of my videos from my original account were on these accounts, and I was obviously very worried because at first glance it just looks like it was my account. Now obviously we've built a trusted brand and reputation around our business and our online pharmacy, and that was obviously being used to then lure other vulnerable patients in. And the worrying thing was there was thousands and thousands of followers on these accounts, and on my videos on these accounts there was hundreds of messages and comments about asking for prices and how do they place an order. So clearly they were getting a lot of uptake from the public.
But you'd imagine that some of those were also bots that were there to try and create the impression. I mean, not all of them, obviously a lot of them be real humans, but some of them would be bots that are there to create the impression of it being a real and plausible account.
Of course.
But for people listening to you, Sihar, who are very worried, including older people who do rely on these pharmacies for convenient medicines, what's the advice? Do we need a sort of kite mark system? How can you actually tell if a pharmacy is legit or not?
Of course. So every regulated pharmacy has to be registered with the General Pharmaceutical Council, and they need to display their registration on their website.
Ah.
Once you click on that registration link, it takes you to the register, and where they'll show whether there's a license there or not. The one thing that I always say to patients is that's not enough. Within that license that's on the register, you need to check the domain that license is linked to, and make sure that domain that's on the register is exactly the domain that you are browsing and purchasing medication from, because these criminal businesses, they have become so sophisticated, and sometimes the domain name that they have now created to replicate your website can just be the change of one digit, one letter.
Yeah, so it looks at that's great advice. So click on the registered number and then check that domain marries the one which they're pretending to be. That's fantastic advice. See, Ashay, thank you very much indeed for taking us through that. Really appreciate your time.
3 minutes to 7. Let's hear now about something new from Radio 3.
How has history shaped classical music?
Of course, it often happens in history that changes in music come with changes in society.
From the birth of musical notation to the digital streaming revolution. Join me, Gillian Moore, and leading experts, including Michael Wood, for an epic journey through 1,000 years of classical music.
What a miracle it is that we can still listen to music from so long ago.
Key Changes, Radio 3's essential history of classical music. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
2 minutes to 7, and Chris Fawkes has got the weather. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Mol, and we're looking at quite a changeable day today. Across England and Wales, we start off with extensive cloud for most areas. There are a few patches of light rain and drizzle across parts of Wales, Midlands, southwest England, and the far north of England too. I think by and large, the weather will try to brighten up with a bit of sunshine coming through for a time. But later this afternoon, more cloud is on the way to Wales and southern England. And with that will come the threat of some afternoon drizzle as well. So turning damp again, leaving the best of the afternoon sunshine across the north and east of England. Temperatures on the mild side, 15 to 17 Celsius. In Northern Ireland, a bright start to the day for many with sunny spells. Could be an odd shower around. Into the afternoon, it turns cloudier with outbreaks of rain and drizzle moving in, along with a strengthening southerly wind. Our temperature's 12 to 14 degrees here. In Scotland, it's a cloudy start to the day with outbreaks of rain, a few heavy bursts mixed in. That should tend to clear through the morning, and by midday, it'll brighten up with sunny spells becoming quite widespread. Later in the afternoon, though, it clouds over across the south and west with outbreaks of drizzle returning. Temperatures for Scotland, 12 to 15 degrees. So quite a changeable day nationwide, I think.
Chris, thank you for that. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Raj and Justin Webb.
It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 16th of April. The headlines. An undercover BBC investigation has found that some migrants are falsely claiming to be victims of domestic abuse to secure the right to stay in the UK. At least 15 people have died in a series of Russian drone and missile strikes across Ukraine overnight. Social media bosses are being summoned to Downing Street to explain what they're doing to protect children from online harm.
And coming up in the next hour, a review of Alzheimer's drugs that were hailed as a game changer for patients has found actually that they seem to make no noticeable difference. And sperm whale clicks work like human language. What are they saying? The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
A BBC investigation has revealed further abuse of the asylum system, with some migrants falsely claiming to be victims of domestic violence in order to stay in the UK. They're exploiting rules brought in to protect genuine victims of abuse to secure a fast-track route to permanent residency. Our politics investigations correspondent Billy Kemper reports.
In an undercover investigation, our reporter posed as a Pakistani migrant to the UK who wanted to leave his British wife, who he was dependent on to stay in the country, to live with his girlfriend. One immigration advisor, Eli Siswaka, said he could make up a story for him that he was the victim of domestic abuse in order to secure leave to remain in the UK. The advisor told our reporter that under special rules for domestic abuse victims, he would then be able to apply for permanent residency without the usual wait. The BBC has also heard concerns from lawyers and people falsely accused of abuse that Home Office checks that accusations are genuine are inadequate. Eli Siswaka denied being willing to make up a story. Jess Phillips, the Home Office Minister, said the abuse of this route was utterly shameful.
The United States says it's holding indirect talks with Iran about resuming peace negotiations in Pakistan. The White House Press Secretary, Caroline Levitt, expressed optimism about the prospect of a deal with Tehran and said discussions were productive and ongoing. A delegation from Pakistan, led by the Chief of the Army, is in Tehran as part of mediation efforts. The BBC's Chief International Correspondent, Lise Doucette, is also in the Iranian capital and has sent this report on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service, restrictions that apply to all international media organisations operating there.
Airports are still shut, so we entered Iran through a Turkish border crossing in the northwest. Many Iranians were doing the same, returning home, hoping a fragile ceasefire will hold. Around the city of Tabriz, we saw military bases and barracks along the road flattened by airstrikes. But for now, the skies are quiet. and diplomacy intensified in Tehran yesterday. Pakistan's army chief brought proposals, trying to narrow the gaps after last weekend's face-to-face talks, as well as discuss an extension to the temporary truce which expires next week.
President Trump has suggested that the leaders of Israel and Lebanon will speak to each other today for the first time in more than 30 years. In a social media post, Mr. Trump said he was trying to get a little breathing room between the two countries. But an official in Lebanon's presidential office said they were not aware of any upcoming contact with Israel. Local authorities in Ukraine say at least 15 people have been killed by Russian strikes overnight. The port of Odessa was one of the worst hit areas. We've just had this report from our correspondent in Kyiv, Sarah Rainsford.
Here in Kyiv, the sirens jolted people awake at 2:30 a.m. and then came a series of loud explosions. The air raid lasted well over 2 hours, and the Russian missiles and drones came in waves. There were strikes in the south and the east of Ukraine too, on the cities of Odessa and Dnipro, where residential buildings were hit and set on fire. In Kyiv, the mayor says a 12-year-old boy was killed and another child rescued from the rubble of their home. In a further air raid this morning, residents in central Kyiv filmed a drone smashing into the side of a block of flats. In all, Russia launched more than 700 drones and missiles at Ukraine, and Ukraine sent more than 200 in the other direction.
The governor of the Bank of England has said there will be no rush to raise interest rates, despite the world facing what he described as a very big energy shock. Andrew Bailey told the BBC the bank was still waiting for meaningful data about how the Iran war was affecting the UK. He was speaking to our economics editor Faisal Islam at the International Monetary Fund meeting in Washington.
The world's finance ministers and central bankers are waiting for clarity from peace talks, for the flow of energy and fertilizer to normalize, and now planning for a scenario where the conflict and uncertainty lasts much longer. The governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, told the BBC the war had not only caused a price shock, but also prompted concerns about global availability of some industrial products needed for fertilisers and plastics. He said the resilience in the system could run out.
This is a very big energy shock, and the real determinant here is the duration of it. So I think we're all trying to come to terms with what is, for many parts of the world, a story of, inflation is going to be higher, and it is going to have a negative effect on activity. So that's a very, very difficult trade-off to deal with in policy terms.
The governor also acknowledged the recent rises in mortgage rates and pointedly said both the bank and the government's best contribution to stabilising the economy would be displaying ongoing credibility, including in fiscal policy. He said, as regards decisions on interest rates, that the bank would not rush to raise interest rates given uncertainties. The next decision will come at the end of the month.
Figures released in the past few minutes by the Office for National Statistics show the UK economy grew by 0.5% in February. A previous estimate of no growth in January has been revised up to 0.1%. The data doesn't show the impact of the Iran war, which began on the last day in February. The government says it's to expand a scheme to cut electricity bills for manufacturing firms from next year. The British Industrial Competitiveness Scheme was first announced last summer and will now be broadened to include around 10,000 companies. Our business editor Simon Jack reports.
When first announced in July last year, this scheme aimed to cut energy bills for 7,000 heavy energy-using manufacturing businesses by 25%. Its expansion to cover 10,000 businesses and backdate payments made in April 2027 to cover bills from April 2026 was welcomed by business groups who have long identified high energy costs as a major handicap. However, all said more needed to be done to address a problem that sees UK firms of all sizes and types paying up to 50% more than competitors in the EU and more than double the rate US businesses pay. The scheme will cost £600 million.
Senior executives from Meta, YouTube, TikTok and other social media companies have been summoned to a meeting at Downing Street today. They'll be challenged by Keir Starmer about the action they're taking to protect children. The government is facing increasing pressure to restrict social media use for the under-16s. Our senior technology reporter Chris Vallance reports.
Number 10 has declined to supply the BBC with the names of the social media company staff attending today's meeting. But whether it's the billionaire tech bosses or more junior representatives, they can expect a stern talking to. The Prime Minister is expected to tell the tech firms they need to step up and take responsibility for protecting children, and that looking the other way is not an option. Today's meeting comes after the government revealed a consultation on Australian-style restrictions on social media use for under-16s has so far attracted 45,000 responses.
An influential review of existing studies has concluded that Alzheimer's drugs that were heralded as a major breakthrough are unlikely to benefit patients. However, the research by the Cochrane Collaboration has provoked arguments, with some scientists labelling it fundamentally flawed. Here's our health and science correspondent James Gallagher.
Alzheimer's drugs are proving controversial. They slow the disease, but at huge expense. Enter the Cochrane Collaboration. The body rigorously and independently analyses medical data. It's looked at 17 studies of drugs that clear a sticky gunge called amyloid from the brain of those with Alzheimer's. It concludes their impact is well below the level needed to make a difference, and other ways of treating the disease should be investigated. But critics say the analysis is unfair, as old experimental drugs have been lumped together with new ones that work.
James Gallagher reporting.
Thank you for that, Jane. 9 minutes past seven is the time. Yesterday on this programme, we exposed how some immigration advisers were helping migrants pretend to be gay to get asylum in the UK. This morning, we bring you the second part of our immigration investigation. It reveals how some people are making false accusations of domestic abuse to exploit other immigration rules to stay in the country. Their lies sometimes having devastating consequences for the British-based partners who are caught up in the scam. Our politics investigations correspondent Billy Kemba has the story. He's been telling me about it.
So this is a different bit of the immigration system. This is a part of the system designed to protect really some of society's most vulnerable people. And so we're talking here about the migrant partners of British citizens or others with status in the UK who are the victims of domestic abuse. And because their status in the country, their visa is dependent on their partner, in that situation, they're left with a choice between staying with their abuser or having to leave the country. And that's why this scheme was brought in more than two decades ago. And it allows someone in that position to apply to the Home Office to receive 3 months temporary leave to remain and then to apply for permanent leave to remain.
And it's being exploited.
It is, yes. So the first part of our investigation, which we brought you yesterday, looking at fake claims being brought for asylum, as part of that, we noticed that some unscrupulous immigration advisers were advertising this domestic abuse route online, advertising it almost as if it was just another type of visa, just another choice you could choose to make as you're looking at your options for staying in the country. And we also obtained figures showing there'd been a really sharp increase in the number of applications under this scheme. They've now reached 5,500 a year for indefinite leave to remain under the scheme. That's a 50% increase in the space of just 2 years. So after gathering evidence, we decided to go undercover and we sent a reporter in with a cover story that they were married to a British partner, but they had a girlfriend and they wanted to leave the British partner to live with the girlfriend. So very clear there was no domestic abuse involved, but looking for a solution to that problem. And it very quickly, this immigration advisor, Eli Siswaka, proposed this.
What evidence are we going to use? Because she doesn't hit me or anything, so there's no domestic violence. So how will it work?
Orally, you two have been having an argument, and she's been telling you things like, remember, I'm the one who brought you here. I'll put your case under psychological domestic abuse.
What is that?
You know when someone's playing with your mind.
So that advisor is saying he's going to make up a story for the reporter that he's in a controlling relationship to help him stay in the country when he leaves his partner for his girlfriend. That's what's being proposed here.
Yes, so he's just making up this story that our reporter is a victim of psychological domestic abuse, controlling behaviour, and that's why he wants to leave his partner, not the real reason, which is that he's got a girlfriend he wants to go and live with instead. And in fact, he's an advisor, but he's not a solicitor and he's not even a registered immigration advisor, as he should be to give immigration advice. And despite that, during the meeting with our undercover reporter at a hotel in central London, he showed them a letter from the Home Office to him showing the success he'd had on behalf of another client under this domestic abuse scheme. Now, we don't know whether that client had genuine claims or not, but it's not clear why the Home Office is dealing with someone who's not a registered immigration advisor or a solicitor. And he said he'd done three other cases like that in the last year alone. We showed our findings to Ana Gonzalez. She's an immigration solicitor with more than two decades' experience working on asylum cases.
The domestic violence provisions are there to protect extremely vulnerable victims of domestic violence. I have had clients who barely escape with their lives, with really abusive husbands that track them down and nearly kill them, and they have to get police protection. So this is no joke.
You wonder as well, Billy, about the impact of all of this on the people who are on the receiving end, if you like, of these allegations.
That's right. And then it can be a really profound impact on those being falsely accused of domestic abuse by people looking to stay in the country and doing it as a means to do that. Eli was an advisor suggesting a false claim, but we also come across cases where people have done it of their own volition. They've learned of this route within their community and decided to pursue it as a possible way of staying in the country. We spoke to one woman whose ex-husband is Pakistani, so he was in the country. He was able to be in the country on a spousal visa linked to her British citizenship. She claimed herself that she was the victim of domestic abuse, and there were police reports and criminal compensation to document that. When she left the relationship after a rape allegation, she told the Home Office that the relationship had broken down, and so her ex-partner was informed that he was going to have to leave the country, and she found out that he'd gone to the police at that point to claim that he was actually the victim of domestic abuse, that she wasn't the victim but the perpetrator, and with that was able to get leave to remain in the country from the Home Office. She says that that's led to further allegations from him, in her view, to bolster her the case he's making. And on one occasion, she was detained in police custody for 8 hours and separated from her then 6-month-old baby, who she was breastfeeding. So really profound impacts for the individuals at the heart of this. We spoke to a criminal defence lawyer. He said he regularly has to represent clients in that situation where they've had false allegations made against them by people whose visas are due to expire.
And what are those, that immigration advisor, Eli Siswaka, and indeed what have the Home Office got to say for it all?
Eli Siswaka didn't respond to a written request for comment, but when we spoke to him on the phone to tell him about our investigation, he denied that he'd been willing to make up a story for that our undercover reporter had been a victim of domestic abuse. The Home Office, the safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, said that the unacceptable abuse of this route, which protects genuine victims from the devastation of domestic abuse, is utterly shameful, in her words. She said that she had personally seen the deplorable impact of this type of underhanded tactic, and that sham lawyers facilitating this advice abuse will be put behind bars.
OK, we'll be talking to a government minister at 10 to 8 for the time being, though. Billy Kemper, thank you.
It's 7:15. Are there going to be direct talks between the leaders of Israel and Lebanon? That is the hope that Donald Trump raised overnight, posting on social media. It has been a long time since the two leaders have spoken, like 34 years. It will happen tomorrow. Nice. But that is not what the government in Lebanon are saying. Let's speak to Hugo Bachega, who's there for us. Hugo, just tell us what the government of Lebanon is saying. What do they think is actually going on?
Yeah, I think this is the latest of presentments on social media that to catch everybody by surprise. He said he was trying to get a little breathing room between Israel and Lebanon, but as usual with the president's posts, there were no details. He didn't specifically mention the names of the Israeli prime minister and the Lebanese president. And the presidency here is saying that they know nothing about. This is an indication that President Trump is paying attention to what's happening here in Lebanon, that there could be an element of American pressure on Israel to get a ceasefire here. This has been a key demand by Iran in its negotiations with the US. And there has been a lot of speculation that Israel could announce a temporary ceasefire here in Lebanon. There has been some sort of de-escalation in the past few days, but the war continues, especially in the south of the country. There's been fighting happening between Hezbollah fighters and Israeli soldiers in the south. And a ceasefire has been the priority for the government here. They say a ceasefire before they can engage in discussions about the bigger issues with Israel.
Just tell us, Hugo, about the sort of damage that Lebanon has taken. What has happened before this de-escalation? What has been happening then in the last week or two?
Yeah, I think a lot of people will remember the last week. There were those devastating airstrikes that really shocked this country. More than 350 people were killed, at least a third of them civilians. These, really shocked people across the country, especially in Beirut, where, you know, areas that were considered to be safe, that hadn't been hit before, were targeted, were hit by Israel. There's also ground invasion happening in the south. There is, again, significant fighting happening between Hezbollah and Israel. We're talking about more than 2,000 people who have been killed in 6 weeks of fighting. A million people have been displaced. So this is one in five of the population here. So there is also a huge humanitarian crisis happening in the country. And I think it's worth mentioning that this is not a war between the state of Lebanon and Israel. This is a war between Hezbollah, which is this powerful militia political party supported by Iran, against Israel. And there have been calls, you know, for Hezbollah to disarm, but so far they have rejected engaging in any kind of discussions, negotiations about the future of its weapons. So it's a very difficult situation for the government here.
Hugo Machega, thank you very much indeed.
And that brings us to 18 minutes past seven. As we were hearing back in the news, the governor of the Bank of England has been talking to us about interest rates in this new and unpredictable world, not rushing to raise rates, saying their decisions are very difficult. Sean has more on that.
Yes, Andrew Bailey describing this very big energy shock, in his words, that's taking place right now, that higher oil and gas prices will feed through to higher household costs. But what does that mean next for those rates? Dame Deanne Julius is the former member of the Monetary Policy Committee at the Bank of England, distinguished fellow at Chatham House as well. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Often the thinking will go, if price rises are too high, interest rates need to be higher. Is that the case here?
Well, I think, as Andrew Bailey said, that it's a bit of a dilemma for the Bank of England because, yes, when you expect inflation to be higher, generally a central bank would raise interest rates. But at the same time, this is the kind of shock that will also depress activity, growth in our economy. And in general, that's the time when a bank, central bank would lower interest rates. So it's a classic case of stagflation. With both low growth and higher inflation, which I think is why Bailey's probably right to say that one shouldn't rush into action in either direction.
Not rushing into it. But the Bank of England does have a target to try and get prices rising at around 2%. So what should be its priority here?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that in the case of the UK, the first priority of the central bank is indeed to hit its inflation target. That's subject to effects on the economy. And of course, what we've seen is that prices are rising, diesel prices in particular, rising faster in our country than the crude oil itself. It is a huge shock from the Middle East, but that creates huge uncertainties. And so I think the part of what Andrew Bailey is trying to do is to calm the markets down, at least, not to have people anticipating that he and the committee are going to be raising interest rates from now on, but rather to say, let's wait and see what the data really shows us.
Did we learn anything from the energy price spikes that we saw, that, you know, the height of the energy crisis with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that might help change the decision-making this time around? Because lots might think, well, the Bank of England changing interest rates isn't going to change an energy shock in the Middle East.
Well, I think we did learn something from the situation of the Russian invasion. And what we learned, actually, was that if a central bank is too slow in countering those price increases, inflation can get rather embedded in the economy. Banks are considered to have been a bit behind the curve in that case. So that's part of the dilemma, you know, certainly in terms of preserving the credibility of the central bank. It should not be falling behind the curve. It should be raising interest rates when inflation is getting out of control, because you don't want to have the second round effects of the oil price shock permeating the rest of the economy. So it's a bit of a tightrope. You know, they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. And I think that's probably why wait and see is the best policy at the moment.
What difference does it make how the economy was doing before this war began. So we've had some latest official numbers out in the last 20 minutes. Bit of a surprise, it seems, that the economy actually grew 0.5% in the month of February. So strong growth in February itself. That can be revised. It's a one-month figure. But actually some growth in January, that's revised upwards from Office for National Statistics, thinking there wasn't any last time. What difference does that make to all of this?
Well, I think it's positive news. It's, as you say, it's 1 month, and these things are often revised as more data comes in. But the January figure had been zero growth. When we look at the actual Q4, the latest quarter official growth that we have, the last quarter of last year, that was 0.1%. So essentially, the economy has been pretty stagnant for the last 6 months, and if one looks longer, even longer than that. So this is a little piece of little chink of good light that in February it looks as though there was more growth, but it doesn't change the overall picture. And certainly the IMF has updated its recent projections, and those also show the UK growing significantly below 1% this year. So we're still in a situation where the economy is not buoyant. An interest rate increase would not help in terms of growth. But the Monetary Policy Committee has to keep its eye first and foremost on inflation.
Dame Deanne Julius, formerly of that Monetary Policy Committee, now at Chatham House. Thank you very much.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. It's 23 minutes past seven. We're going to talk about sperm whales. They really are some of the most astonishing creatures in our oceans. The largest toothed predator on the planet. They've got the biggest brain of any animal on Earth. They've got heads that are close to one third of their bodies. They can hold their breath for 2 hours, and they make the loudest sound of any creature, emitting clicks that can reach up to 230 decibels. That's really quite loud. These clicks are emitted in short sequences called coders, and new research out this week suggests that these coders bear a remarkable similarity to human language. Sperm whales, it turns out, differentiate vowels either through short or long clicks, and they also make tonal adjustments in patterns that resemble Latin and Mandarin, among other languages. Here's a reminder of what those sounds sound like. Does that sound like Latin or Mandarin to you, Justin? I'm not entirely sure it does.
Both, actually.
Yeah. both at the same time. Professor John Copley is a marine biologist at the University of Southampton. Joins us now to reflect on these findings from Project SETI. Professor Copley, good morning.
Good morning, Emil.
Thank you so much for joining us. Just tell us how this new research advances our understanding of the language used by sperm whales.
So what this new research shows is that in addition to being able to encode information in the series of clicks, a bit like Morse code, whether you've got a dot or a dash, actually within the dot or the dash itself, there's another way of encoding information. Because as you mentioned, you can actually have something that differs in tone, differs in more in length and so on, in the overall frequency of each individual sound. So it shows us that their communication is richer in content than we'd perhaps realised.
Not that we can decipher the language necessarily and what they mean by it, what they're saying. It is an extraordinary piece of engineering that allows them to create these sounds. How do sperm whales make the loudest sound in nature?
It's absolutely phenomenal how they make the sound, because it's very, very different to how we are making sounds talking right now. So what they have to do, of course, is make these sounds while they're underwater holding their breath.
Exactly.
So if you close your mouth and you pinch off your nose and you try and hum, you don't hum for very long, because there's nowhere for the air to go as it passes over your vocal cords from your lungs. So sperm whales make the sounds actually in their noses, and they have air sacs in their noses, and they move the air between the air sacs over structures that are similar to our vocal cords, but really very different, because they're called phonic lips, and they're actually in their noses. They're not in their throats at all. So they're producing the sounds in very different way to us.
And that sound has to reach very, very distances, I mean, very high volumes, but distances very, very far away. But it does it having migrated or gone through spermaceli, which is about a third of their bodies, isn't it?
That's right. And that's also a material that they use for buoyancy during their dives. So that's something that fills up a large area in a large volume in their head. And it's a waxy like substance, and it changes from a solid to a liquid during a dive. And that changes its volume. And that therefore either helps them to sink or to float without having to expend so much energy on swimming. So they've got that in their heads as well. When they're talking to each other, they're usually very close, often kind of pressing their heads up against each other, to fire these clicks between individuals.
There's always a danger for amateur scientists and lovers of nature, like you might get on this program, Professor Copley, that we anthropomorphize, that we imagine them sort of conducting human language and human sentiment. What hope do we have of ever understanding the meaning behind their clicks as well as the volume of them?
Well, that's a really big question. So let's imagine if we could decode the equivalent of a word or a couple of words, some sort of sound that conveys meaning. Even then, how far could we be from understanding any kind of communication, any kind of conversation? Because it might be that they communicate entirely through metaphor, through cultural reference. So who knows?
Who knows?
A long way
who
off
knows?
That.
Well, when you find out, do come back on the radio and let us know, won't you? John Copley, Professor John Copley, marine biologist at the University of Southampton. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
29 minutes past 7 to the sport. Here's Mike.
Trying to think if there's any connection between sperm whales and last night's action in the Champions League. I've spent 4 minutes trying to think, and I don't think there is. So
nice try, though.
Yeah, well, you know, we're anything if not joined up on this programme. Let's talk football, though, because it might not have been pretty, but Arsenal are through to the semi-finals of the Champions League.
Well, what a struggle that was between these two teams. The Portuguese champion Sporting are out, and Arsenal have found a way through thanks to that one goal that Havertz scored in Lisbon right at the end of the first leg. Mikel Arteta, he called for fire tonight. It was like torture.
Yes, Arsenal 0, Sporting Lisbon 0 on the night. Enough to send Arsenal through to the semi-finals, 1-0 on aggregate. You heard the familiar voice of correspondent John Murray on commentary at the Emirates last night. He's with us in the studio this morning. Hi, John.
Morning.
So was that an accomplished defensive masterclass from Arsenal doing what they had to do, or was it actually pretty nervy by the end?
I can tell you it was tense, it was nervy, it was not pretty at all, but it was effective. And I think rightly so, Mikel Arteta, the manager, afterwards talking up their achievement of reaching the Champions League semi-final 2 years running. Arsenal have never done that before. They are still unbeaten in that competition. Champions League as big as it's ever been. They are into the semi-finals. They play Atletico Madrid there, who they've already beaten 4-0 in the competition this season. The second leg of that will be here in London. But that feeling on the final whistle in the stadium was unmistakable relief. That's where they are right now.
Gunners lacking fire, say the Sun on their back page. Arsenal look at a fading force. Nervy Arsenal, say the Times. Telegraph sports section, job done, just. And the Daily Mail, what do they say? Arsenal remain racked by nerves is their take on it. Word on the manager, John, Mikel Arteta. A lot of pressure on him as this season comes to a climax. What did he have to say afterwards?
Well, if he's listening this morning, my advice would be to Mikel Arteta, don't read the newspapers. He did. He came up with that extraordinary quote in advance of this match when he said, "I'm on fire." But it felt at times last night, though they were a whisker away from everything going up in smoke, really, for them, they would love to be doing this in style. But they've not won the Premier League for 22 years. They've never won the Champions League. It is about getting over the line. And one little thing he did tell us last night, which I thought was interesting, in the absence of Martin Odegaard, the club captain, who's not playing at the moment, Declan Rice, Mikel Arteta said, it's been decided by the players that Declan Rice, rather than Gabriel, will be the captain, as Rice has been for the last couple of matches.
Interesting.
So a significant little change.
And just a brief word on the wider context of last night's match, of course, feeding into this weekend, Sunday afternoon, a potentially title-deciding match in the Premier League against against Manchester City. What will last night's performance and subsequent statements afterwards have done in the minds of Arsenal fans feeding into that?
What we do know is that all roads now lead to Manchester in the Premier League, 4:30 Sunday afternoon. Manchester City and Pep Guardiola have had all week to prepare for that. They will have enjoyed seeing Arsenal being put through the ringer. I would say the teams are in two very different places at the moment, but it is the most anticipated Premier League match of the season. And I know that Justin will realise that there are places to watch it, but I would suggest the place to listen to it is Five Live.
With your good self.
4:30, Justin.
On Sunday
afternoon.
Set your alarm
in your diary.
Yeah, Justin Amell, we will all be listening to that on Sunday. John Murray, always a pleasure. Many thanks for that. Should just say the other quarterfinal last night was an absolute thriller in Germany. 7 goals between Bayern Munich and Real Madrid saw the German champions emerge victorious, beating the 15-time European champions 4-3 on the night, 6-4 on aggregate in that match. Harry Kane, England captain, scoring his 50th goal of the season.
Wonderful. Mike, John, thank you both very much indeed. Here's what's coming up on Radio 4.
I'm Matthew Bannister, and I've been presenting Radio 4's obituary programme, Last Word, for 20 years. During that time, I've noticed big changes in the way we approach death and how we're remembered. In doing death differently, I'll be chronicling those changes by attending a bespoke funeral infused with nature, taking you on the procession to the Liverpool Pyramid of the Dead, going behind the scenes at the only licensed water cremation facility in Europe, and thanks to AI, having a conversation from beyond the grave. Last Word, doing death differently, next Monday to Friday at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
To the weather, variable cloud across the UK, showers in northern Scotland. Later, though, turning cloudy. Well, it will already be cloudy, won't it, if it's variable cloud? Anyway, some rain as well.
Also, you do get variable crowds as well across the UK.
I suppose you do get variable.
Yeah, a bit of everything today. A hodgepodge. A review of Alzheimer's drugs that were hailed as a game changer for patients has in fact found they make almost no noticeable difference. We'll have more on that in about 10 minutes' time.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4, the Mulraj and Justin Webb. It is 27 minutes to 8. Jane Steele has the news.
A BBC investigation has discovered that migrants are falsely claiming to be victims of domestic abuse in order to stay in the country. They're exploiting rules brought in by ministers to help genuine victims of abuse to secure permanent residence more quickly than through other routes, such as asylum. President Trump has suggested that the leaders of Israel and Lebanon will speak to each other today for the first time in more than 30 years. But an official in Lebanon's presidential office has told the BBC that the country is not aware of any upcoming contact with Israel. Ukraine says at least 15 people have been killed and dozens injured in overnight Russian missile and drone attacks across the country. 4 people died in missile strikes on the capital, Kyiv, including a 12-year-old child. Another 3 were killed in Dnipro in central Ukraine. The governor of the Bank of England has said there will be no rush to raise interest rates, despite the world facing what he described as a very big energy shock. Andrew Bailey told the BBC that higher oil and gas prices would certainly feed through, but other factors made a decision on rates extremely difficult. Figures released by the Office for National Statistics show the UK economy grew by 0.5% in February. A previous estimate of no growth in January has been revised up to 0.1%. The data does not show the impact of the Iran war, which began on the last day in February. Sir Keir Starmer has summoned senior figures from TikTok, X, Meta and other social media companies to Downing Street to push them to go further on protecting children. The government is facing increasing pressure to restrict social media use for the under-16s. A new review has found that drugs that are said to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease make no meaningful difference to patients, while increasing the risk of swelling and bleeding in the brain. But some scientists have challenged the findings from the Cochrane collaboration, saying the research is fundamentally flawed.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It's now 24 minutes to 8, as you heard Jane say there. We've now had the second instalment of undercover reporting from Billy Kenba and also from Phil Kemp, showing that another way in which illegal migrants try to solicit help to stay in the UK is by claiming they are victims of domestic abuse, when in fact they are not. The idea is that it allows them to change their spousal visa into a right to remain. Downing Street responded to yesterday's reporting by saying, and I quote, that any attempt to make false asylum claims is deplorable and lawyers assisting people to do so could be referred to the police. Well, Gayon Hart is the Immigration Services Commissioner and Interim Chair of the NHS Counter-Fraud Authority and joins us now. Gayon, Mr. Hart, good morning.
Thank you, and please do call me Gayon.
Gayon, well, thank you very much indeed for joining us, Gayon. A lot of people were pretty shocked by what they heard on this programme yesterday, were you?
Unfortunately not. The abhorrent abuse of the system that we're finding is sort of an issue that we've been facing for quite a while. Last year, for example, we had a significant number of enforcement actions against complaints, against people who were actually giving advice unregulated, but also manipulating the system or giving improper advice. And we are ramping up. We've already been in discussions with the Home Office. They're significantly increasing our funding in order to be able to ramp up such investigations and prosecutions.
Who is the regulator? Why are they not doing a good enough job?
Well, none of these individuals were regulated, I have to say, by us. We are the regulator for a lot of 4,000 individual advisors who are charitable sector, who are non-profit to a certain extent, but also companies. We do not regulate the solicitors, and we apply a huge number of guide rails in order to make sure that we protect and ensure that our advisors are fully operational. But there is abuse. Wherever there is potential for greed, there is and will be abuse, and we will be addressing it.
Well, let's talk about that abuse. So we know from our reporting, from the undercover work that Billy Kenber and colleagues have done, that many fraudulent applications are being put in. That's, you know, news to us and our listeners. You say that because you're familiar with the area, it's not news to you, but it's shocking to a lot of people. What we can't know is how many of those fraudulent applications are actually being approved. Do you have any sense of how many of those fraudulent applications are getting through the system?
Unfortunately, no. It doesn't come to us. We have an online reporting system. We work closely with the Home Office on their referrals. So, for example, they referred over 400 cases to us over the last couple of years where they had suspicions, and they put that through to our investigation. So we do know that there's a significant number that the Home Office are picking up, and they are referring to us.
So you say that you are the regulator for, you regulate the and enforce the rules around these advisors, but not the solicitors. And it's worth saying, a lot of these advisors, as you say, they're often in the charitable sector. They're not always very well paid at all, and they're often helping very, very vulnerable people. But a lot of them are leaving the industry. What can be done to stop those advisors leaving the industry, A, and B, to recruit better ones and new ones?
Yeah, it's one of our ambitions is to increase the sector by around 30%. It's a challenging area. I mean, everybody who goes to a party, if you talk and say, I'm an immigration advisor, you can imagine the level of interest. There's a lot of extreme feelings, all of them understandable, all from different perspectives. It's a really tough industry. And I should emphasize, the majority of people that we see are really altruistic, very, very impressive advisors. And it's the small few that bring down the reputation of the sector. What needs to be done is we need to give more confidence. So what we're doing is we're coming up with academic qualifications. We're what we call professionalizing the sector. There are a number of professional people in the sector, but as a whole, I think it needs to increase its reputation. We need greater legislative agentic co-pilot tools. We're working with social media, hopefully, to remove illegal adverts. We're trying to enhance the profile and to demonstrate how good such advisors are, and they help some of the most vulnerable in society.
I can hear that you're keen to emphasise that point. Of course, we understand it. But why are they leaving in the sector? I mean, I hear what you say about you go along to a party and say, I'm an immigration advisor. You're not necessarily the most popular person in the room. But why are so many people leaving? What is it about the job that makes it so unattractive?
I think it's because it has extreme feelings, and there are threats to advisors. We've seen a significant ramping up of literally physical threats to people who give very legitimate advice. It's a very difficult area to work in. You have to be a specialist. The law changes regularly. We've been talking for 10 minutes. The legislation has probably changed slightly in that period of time. So you need to enhance your capability. A lot of advisors talk to me about having to look at cases over the weekends. It's a difficult area that people do because they're passionate about it.
And also it's high stakes, right? Because you're talking, it's high stakes for the people who, you know, who often employ criminals to try and stay in the country because it's about where they're going to live. What do you think can be done immediately to try and stop this kind of abuse and these kind of fraudulent applications going in? And would you just sort of delicately or politely say to our listeners, look, in the end, when you have an immigration system, you're going to have people try to abuse it?
I wouldn't say that because I don't think we should accept it. I mean, we should understand it, but we shouldn't accept it. Greed will always be there. I think one of the key is we have an online check and online reporting system. If we want more people to report to us, we want advisors to report other advisors so they can help raise the reputation of their profession. We want immigrants who are being abused and who are receiving poor advice in order to be able to report to us. And we will take those enforcement actions. And we are in discussions, as I say, with the Home Office. They have offered significant increased funding. And we will be taking action over the next couple of years. So it isn't a question of accept it. It's a question of please report it. Please come to us. The IAA has an online website. And we want more intelligence. We have a significantly increased intelligence, investigation and prosecution team. And we are open to invite people to come forward.
Is it, I mean, you're a solicitor yourself, is it not a little bit messy that you've got a bunch of advisors, some of them leaving the profession who are regulated, and solicitors who aren't?
Well, they are regulated. Solicitors are regulated by the SRA. So I wouldn't say they're not regulated, but they don't necessarily have the similar guardrails, such as in order to be regulated by us, you have to go through three levels of tests.
That's what I mean. Regulated to do what you do is what I mean, of course.
Yes. And I think it would, we are working closely and collaborating with the SRA to try and look at their guardrails. We get a significant number of complaints. We do pass them forward to the SRA, and we are working with them. We know they have a very keen new head who's looking at this area as well, because I've spoken to her myself. So it is one of those challenges that it is. We do need greater clarity in the sector. It's not just the SRA and solicitors. There are separate regulators for the barristers. There are separate regulators for Silects. And what we were trying to do with everyone is to collaborate closer and to maybe get greater clarity and simplicity in the system. I think that would help.
OK. Gayon Hart, Immigration Services Commissioner, thank you very much indeed.
17 minutes to 8 is the time. The grimmest of news this morning about Alzheimer's drugs. Basically, as we were hearing in the news, they don't seem to work. Although some scientists dispute the findings of the study that has found that. Let us talk to James Gallagher, our health and science correspondent, who's on the line. Tell us first, James, about what the study is that seems to be suggesting these drugs don't work.
Yeah, there's some very muddy water. It takes a lot of unpicking this morning, Justin. So this is a review by the Cochrane Collaboration, and their job is to analyse all the existing evidence. So they looked at lots of different studies of lots of different drugs, and they're trying to tease apart this idea that if you target this gungy, sticky protein called amyloid that builds up in the brain during Alzheimer's disease, whether targeting that helps alleviate some of the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. So what they did is they looked at 17 studies of different drugs that use this approach, and they concluded that while statistically you can say that there is a benefit to this approach, the size of that benefit is so small that it's basically trivial. It's no way near the amount of improvement that would make a meaningful difference to a patient's life. It wouldn't be the amount of difference that anybody would notice.
So where does it leave the drugs and the people getting them?
Well, at the moment, unless you have a casual 90K lying around in your back pocket that you can pay for these drugs privately, these aren't available on the NHS. So the National Institutes of Health and Care Excellence have already reviewed the evidence on these, concluded that they were far, 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 far too expensive for NHS use based on how much they cost. Now, that is being reviewed again at the moment with some changes to the cost effectiveness guidelines as part of negotiations with the United States, but also to take into account some of the wider costs, kind of like the costs of all that unpaid care that goes into having a family member with Alzheimer's disease, to see if they do meet that cost effectiveness threshold for the NHS to use. But I think where it leaves us is that you have two quite, you know, esteemed camps of Alzheimer's researchers and scientists on very different sides of a debate about whether these drugs have any meaningful impact for patients.
James Gallagher, thank you.
Well, in a few minutes, we'll talk to the business secretary about whether the government's new measures will help businesses on energy costs and whether that is enough. For now, let's turn to Thought for the Day at 14 minutes to 8. The speaker this morning is Martin Rowe, writer on culture and spirituality. Good morning.
Good morning. I read in the Times that growing numbers of vegetarians are returning to meat, dairy and fish. They have concerns about getting enough protein or about ultra-processed plant-based meals. One in four of those who once followed a vegetarian diet no longer do so. They are instead flexitarian. A flexitarian is defined as a person who has a primarily vegetarian diet, but occasionally eats meat or fish, and may be seen by vegans or vegetarians, at least in my experience, as a lightweight, a part-timer, an amateur. As a long-time flexitarian, I know how quickly this position can be mocked. I would like to respond to my friends, quoting Jesus, "Judge not that ye be not judged," but that might sound a bit judgy. And my friends are right when they remind me of the connection between the industrial production of meat and global warming, and of the health benefits of meat-free diets. The trouble is that most of our lives are great ships, which take a while to turn course, which is why the idea of being flexitarian may be one whose time has come, not just for diets, but as a wider philosophy in life. Flexitarianism says that the perfect is the enemy of the good, that something is better than nothing. It stands in contrast to the furious fundamentalisms that emerge in religion and politics in days of uncertainty, an age that takes comfort in absolutes, in purity culture, in cancelling those you disagree with, an age that judges you. Flexitarianism chimes with the ancient Chinese proverb that the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. It's more about practice than perfection, more the pilgrim's progress than the pilgrim's arrival. Easter brought an end to the 6-week Christian season of Lent, and whatever people gave up, they may now have taken back up, but maybe with a twist. A while ago, 5 of us in our household decided to go meat-free for Lent. Several years on, 2 of us are vegan and 2 of us flexitarian. Humans may be more incrementalist than fundamentalist. It would be good if the way ahead was illuminated, like it was for Paul the Apostle, caught in a dazzling floodlight on the Damascus Road. But for most of us, the light is more intermittent, the route not always clear. A flexitarian approach is one way of getting to the place we like to get to, knowing we can't get there all at once. The Catholic priest Henry Nouwen understood this when he said, "You don't think your way into a new kind of living, you live your way into a new kind of thinking."
And that was Thought for the Day with Martin Rowe. Brings us to 11 minutes to 8. Nobody is suggesting that the war in Iran, the economic impact on Britain, is the fault of the government here. They are suggesting, though, very strongly that there are things the government ought to be doing, but is not yet doing. Some want more drilling for oil and gas. We discussed that yesterday. Heard nothing new, it is fair to say, from the Treasury Minister. Some want the focus on simply helping companies with their huge energy costs. And what the government is saying this morning is that some help, at least, is on its way. Electricity prices for some companies are going to be reduced. Peter Kyle, the Secretary of State for Business and Trade, is on the line. Morning to you.
Morning, Justin.
Tell
it's great
us,
to be with
you. Tell us what you're proposing.
Well, we're proposing to expand the BIC scheme, the British Industrial Competitiveness Scheme. This is aimed at high energy intensive using manufacturing companies. So we've already announced a scheme for 7,000. I'm expanding it by another 3,000 today. That means that these businesses will get a reduction of about 25% of their electricity costs. What I'm targeting today, because it's really important to target at times like this, is those foundational industries, so we're talking steel and chemicals and so forth, for whom, if I can lower the costs for, it will have a downstream impact on lowering costs throughout the economy. This is a scheme that I've been working on for growth purposes. Of course, now that the Iran situation has happened, of course, these sorts of measures are going to have an added prescience. So I'm adding to the scheme when it's announced next April, when it's launched next April.
Next April?
When it is launched next April.
They'll be out of business quite a few of them.
When it is we'll come back to resilience in a second, but when it's launched next April and the energy costs are reduced by 25%, there will be a one-off payment that would also cover costs which would have been incurred in the current period. But bear in mind, Justin, that you know, I listened to the show, I listened to the interview you did earlier with Sharon from Tees Components. As she explained, she is in a contract which has a fixed cost for the next year for her business. That is the norm for the kind of businesses that we're talking about. out here. We need to make sure that we as a government, we target, we support, we make sure we get it right.
Well, answer her then, because I mean, it was interesting. I'm glad you heard it, because we all listened to it. She's the managing director of Tees Components, and she said, I don't know whether I'm getting this or not. So tell her, is she getting it?
Well, that's why we're working. So look, I've announced the scheme today. We are working with businesses to
But with respect, just announcing a scheme, if you're a business person and you're listening to this, you want to know, don't you, will I qualify or not? Am I likely to qualify or not? So tell her, is she likely to qualify or not?
Well, I'll tell her in specific terms that we are working with businesses to make sure we get the eligibility criteria right. And then in the summer, we will announce an eligibility tool which she can go in and put all of the circumstances of her business, and she will be able to know within the next few months whether she will qualify for it or not.
But she wouldn't get the money until next April.
The scheme starts in April, and those who qualify will get a one-off payment which will cover the costs that are incurred this
year. When will they
get
the payment?
In April, on the first, at the start of it.
Right, so if they've gone out of business in the meantime, there's nothing.
But Justin, look, we are looking very carefully at this, and I understand that for the purposes of the moment we're in, and we're having a conversation today, that it is that you will make assumptions that every business is in the same circumstance. Most businesses that we are targeting will have, because of the need for electricity on as part of their high costs of doing their business, they will be in contracts or they will be hedging their costs and hedging their energy supplies. So most businesses do not have that we are targeting with this scheme. Their electricity costs will not be rising immediately. So we are working really closely to make sure this is a scheme that's appropriate for the businesses that we are targeting.
Getting it right
is better than trying to spread it too thinly.
Another point about the scheme there that she raised, does the scheme involve the supply chain? Is it just high users of energy, or is it the entire supply chain? She was talking in the industrial processes of things like coatings, manufacturers, etc., etc. Are they in or out?
Well, as I said, we will announce the precise criteria so that in the summer, every manufacturer can check their availability and their eligibility for the scheme. But we are targeting businesses that have high electricity costs in order to do as a percentage of their doing businesses. So look, to be technical about it.
So just going on to, I mean, there are lots of businesses using a lot of electricity at the moment and really facing difficulties. I mean, right across the piece, including hospitality, including all sorts of people who are not necessarily high users, but nonetheless are paying these extra costs, and they are extra costs imposed by the government, aren't they? How about them?
I've done a lot of interventions in the 6 months that I've been in this job, including getting a small business plan out the door. That small business plan, we are legislating so that small businesses get paid on time. That would unlock £11 billion into the economy, and that's just one measure that I've been taking. So we can't just look at one aspect when it comes to something like hospitality. They face many, many challenges many areas we can ease the burden of doing businesses, such as late payments, that will make business more profitable and more resilience into those sectors. So we're acting right across the different sectors, looking at the individual challenges, because there isn't just one thing we can do that will ease all of the challenges. But bearing in mind, the number one mission of this government is economic growth. You've just seen the growth figures that were coming in up until the point of the Iran invasion, the Iran conflict. Growth was going in the right direction, and we were beating forecasts.
Yeah, all right.
The measures that I'm announcing today were designed for growth, for resilience, and we are also working really hard to make sure we lower the energy costs across the board through moving to renewables.
As well about the immigration system, because it is such a huge story, and it's been our main story actually both yesterday and today. Reform are saying this morning it should be a criminal offence to aid and abet a false claim of asylum. A criminal case, they say, should be punishable by up to 2 years in jail. Why not do that?
Shabana Mahmood is looking at this. She's already said that what's been uncovered is appalling. She thinks that anybody who has been lying for asylum seeking on their asylum seeking process is an abuse of the hospitality and of our country, the generosity of our country, and they will be expecting a one-way ticket. Look, I'm gay myself, so to know that there are still countries around the world that use the death penalty for being gay, to know that there are people that are being encouraged to claim that they're gay to get through an asylum process, it makes me sick to my stomach, and I hope that they are prosecuted.
Jackie Smith, when she was Home Secretary 20 years or so ago, sent people back to Iran who said they were gay and said you just have to live discreetly. I just wonder whether you believe, as a gay man yourself, that we have left ourselves open because we are, and it's actually not just people who say they're gay, but people who say they're atheists, people who say all sorts of things about their religious beliefs or other sets of beliefs. They're unfalsifiable claims. And if you are depending your system on unfalsifiable claims, you are leaving yourself open for it to be abused. However much you say you'll go after the abusers, the abuse, the invitation to abuse is there.
Now, I think that the people who do the casework in the front line of this, they are highly experienced. Will we get it right in these sorts of cases 100% of the time? Probably not. No. But are we able to get this right in a majority of cases? I think yes. The challenge is when you have companies who are tutoring people to exploit these sorts of situations. Now, asylum is always going to be challenging. The circumstances that force people to flee a country are challenging. The kind of burden of proof you would expect when you have situations where people are born and raised in the UK are not going to exist for people who are fleeing other countries. Do we want to remain a generous, a hospitable and humane country when it comes to people who are genuinely fleeing? Then yes. How we get that right, of course, is always going to be a bone of contention. But what was uncovered today, and I think the thing that makes people angry and makes me angry, is that there are people who are profiting from tutoring people to exploit that system, okay. And that is disgusting.
Peter Carr, thank you.
The stories we tell.
About the people we know.
And the places we love.
Are not just made here.
They're stories made of here.
If you could go anywhere in the world, where would you go?
Glasgow.
So where are you from then?
The Big Glens of Antrim.
Lovely part of the world.
Can you just move to Barry? It's well lush.
Hello, love. Welcome to Barry. You'll always be
my home. Made of Belfast.
Liverpool. Cornwall. Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
Let us turn to the weather at 2 minutes to eight with Chris Fawkes.
That's a lot, Justin. And looking at the weather picture this morning, there's quite a lot of cloud across the UK. There are a few bright or sunny spells for Northern Ireland, eastern counties of England as well. But at the same time, the cloud thick enough to give a bit of drizzle at the moment across parts of southwest England, through the Midlands, the far north of England and Scotland, where it's quite a wet start for some. Now, as we go through the morning, by and large, the drizzle will fizzle and for most parts, the sunshine will come out. So a decent spell of weather for a time. However, later on today, we are going to see the cloud thicken up from the southwest as a warm front moves in. So for Northern Ireland, for Wales and southern counties of England, later this afternoon it is going to turn cloudier and we'll see some drizzle returning to southwest England, Wales and Northern Ireland, seeing some fairly persistent rain to end the day on a strengthening southerly wind. That will leave the best of the sunshine for the north and east of Scotland and across some eastern counties of England as we head through this afternoon. It is a mild day, temperatures 12 to 15 degrees for Scotland and Northern Ireland, England and Wales 15 to 17 Celsius, your top temperatures today. Overnight tonight, outbreaks of rain spread to northern and western areas of the UK with strengthening southerly winds working in. It's going to be a mild night, temperatures 9 or 10 degrees. And tomorrow, we've got this band of rain pushing eastwards, bringing little if any rain as far east as East Anglia and southeast England. But as the rain stalls across the Midlands, behind that it'll brighten up with a mixture of sunshine and showers working in. Quite windy across the northwest of the UK, temperatures between 12 and 18 degrees tomorrow.
Chris, thank you. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Amol Rajan.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 16th of April. The headlines this morning. The BBC has uncovered more abuse of the immigration system, this time with people falsely claiming to be victims of domestic violence to stay in the UK. Ukraine says Russia has attacked cities across the country with hundreds of drones and missiles, killing 15 people. And a major review of a new wave of Alzheimer's drugs has concluded that they're unlikely to benefit patients.
Coming up in the next hour, Lise Doucette joins us straight after the news from inside Iran. Can you name Charlotte Bronte's brother or Mozart's sister or Muhammad Ali's younger brother? We celebrate the siblings who didn't quite make the grade. And a remarkable new study rewrites human evolution. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
A BBC investigation has revealed further abuse of the asylum system, with some migrants falsely claiming to be victims of domestic violence in order to stay in the UK. They're exploiting rules brought in to protect genuine victims of abuse to secure a fast-track route to permanent residency. Our politics investigations correspondent Billy Kemba reports.
In an undercover investigation, our reporter posed as a Pakistani migrant to the UK who wanted to leave his British wife, who he was dependent on to stay in the country, to live with his girlfriend. One immigration advisor, Eli Siswaka, said he could make up a story for him that he was the victim of domestic abuse in order to secure leave to remain in the UK. The advisor told our reporter that under special rules for domestic abuse victims, he would then be able to apply for permanent residency without the usual wait. The BBC has also heard concerns from lawyers and people falsely accused of abuse that Home Office checks that accusations are genuine are inadequate. Eli Siswaka denied being willing to make up a story. Jess Phillips, the Home Office Minister, said the abuse of this route was utterly shameful.
The United States says it's holding indirect talks with Iran about resuming peace negotiations in Pakistan. The White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt said discussions were productive and ongoing.
We feel good about the prospects of a deal. The president mentioned that in his interview yesterday. And it's obviously in the best interest of Iran to meet the president's demands. I think he's made his red lines in these negotiations very clear.
A delegation from Pakistan is in Tehran as part of mediation efforts. The BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is also in the Iranian capital. We're able to broadcast her report on the condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service, restrictions that apply to all international media organisations operating there.
Airports are still shut, so we entered Iran through a Turkish border crossing in the northwest. Many Iranians were doing the same, returning home, hoping a fragile ceasefire will hold. The more than 12-hour journey to the capital takes even longer these days after an Israeli attack destroyed a main bridge, forcing travellers to take a winding rural route. Around the city of Tabriz, we saw military bases and barracks along the road flattened by airstrikes. But for now, the skies are quiet, and diplomacy intensified in Tehran yesterday. One of the main mediators, Pakistan's army chief, Field Marshal Asim Munir, brought proposals, trying to narrow the gaps after last weekend's face-to-face talks, as well as discuss an extension to the temporary truce which expires next week.
President Trump has suggested that the leaders of Israel and Lebanon will speak to each other today for the first time in more than 30 years. In a social media post, Mr. Trump said he was trying to get a little breathing room between the two countries. But an official in Lebanon's presidential office said they were not aware of any upcoming contact with Israel. Government analysis suggests the choice of foodstuffs on supermarket shelves could be restricted if the Strait of Hormuz remains closed until June. Officials have been drawing up contingency plans in case the conflict in the Middle East continues until the summer. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
Government officials believe food shortages are unlikely even if the conflict continues, but the variety of products on supermarket shelves could be affected. As first reported in the Times newspaper, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz could restrict the supply of CO2, which is widely used in the food industry, including in the slaughtering of pigs and chickens. Sources are stressing that a lack of choice on the shelves is a reasonable worst-case scenario if the conflict continues and coincides with a fall in European CO2 production. A government spokesperson told the BBC that reasonable worst-case scenarios should be seen as planning tools used by experts and were not a prediction of future events. Officials said the temporary reopening of a CO2 plant on Teesside would significantly boost production and have suggested this is evidence that action will be taken to mitigate the impact of the Iran war.
Local authorities in Ukraine say at least 15 people have been killed by Russian strikes overnight. The port of Odessa was one of the worst hit areas. We've just had this report from our correspondent in Kiev, Sarah Rainsford.
Here in Kiev, the sirens jolted people awake at 2:30 a.m. and then came a series of loud explosions. The air raid lasted well over 2 hours and the Russian missiles and drones came in waves. There were strikes in the south and the east of Ukraine too, on the cities of Odessa and Dnipro, where residential buildings were hit and set on fire. In Kyiv, the mayor says a 12-year-old boy was killed and another child rescued from the rubble of their home. In a further air raid this morning, residents in central Kyiv filmed a drone smashing into the side of a block of flats. In all, Russia launched more than 700 drones and missiles at Ukraine, and Ukraine sent more than 200 in the other direction.
Preliminary data from the Office for National Statistics shows the UK economy grew by 0.5% in February, outstripping the expectations of some economists. A previous estimate of zero GDP growth in January was revised up to 0.1%. The data does not show the impact of the Iran war, which began on the last day of February. Here's our Deputy Economics Editor, Darshini David.
In normal times, these numbers, although volatile and subject to revision, would suggest that 2026 might be shaping up as a year of renewed prosperity for the UK. The robust expansion in February reached across much of the service, energy production and construction sectors. But the war may have changed the outlook considerably since. Both the IMF and OECD have warned that the UK could face the greatest threat to growth of any major nation, due in part to reliance on imported gas. Nevertheless, this snapshot suggests the economy approached the conflict on firmer ground than assumed, and so may be better equipped to bounce back if there's a rapid resolution, something the Chancellor, currently attending the IMF meetings in Washington, has again urged.
Senior executives from Meta, YouTube, TikTok and other social media companies have been summoned to a meeting at Downing Street today. They'll be challenged by Keir Starmer about the action they're taking to protect children from online harm. The government is facing increasing pressure to restrict social media use for the under-16s, but last night MPs rejected a second bid from the Lords to bring in an immediate social media ban for young people. An influential review of existing studies has concluded that Alzheimer's drugs that were heralded as a major breakthrough are unlikely to benefit patients. However, the research by the Cochrane collaboration has provoked arguments, with some scientists labelling it fundamentally flawed. Here's our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
Alzheimer's drugs are proving controversial. They slow the disease, but at huge expense. Campaigners want them on the NHS. Others say they're not worth the money. Enter the Cochrane Collaboration. The body rigorously and independently analyses medical data. It's looked at 17 studies of drugs that clear a sticky gunge called amyloid from the brain of those with Alzheimer's. It concludes their impact is well below the level needed to make a difference, and other ways of treating the disease should be investigated. But critics say the analysis is unfair, as old experimental drugs have been lumped together with new ones that work. It means the debate over these medicines continues as the drugs watchdog reassesses whether the NHS should fund them, and patients are told they will cost them around £90,000 privately.
The Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, has become the latest victim of potholes. It's emerged her car had to be towed away after it hit a large dip in the road as she drove back to her Swindon South constituency. Here's our correspondent, John Sudworth.
It's the kind of impact lobbyists and campaigners can only dream of. The simple pothole lying in wait for the Transport Secretary on the B4437 in Oxfordshire last month delivered its message by leaving her car in need of breakdown assistance. The Sun newspaper has a photo of the green Mini Cooper on the back of a recovery lorry and a quote from Ms. Alexander joking that the Artemis II astronauts might have seen a similar-sized crater on their way round the moon. She added that she thought it was the experience of far too many people in the country at the moment.
John Sudworth reporting.
Thank you for that. Just coming up to 8:10 is the time. The White House is confident. The markets are up. We feel good about the prospects of a deal, the White House press secretary said. And Donald Trump also seems to think that a stumbling block to a US-Iran deal, Israel's attacks on targets in Lebanon, might itself soon be cleared with talks between the two sides, although the Lebanese authorities have said this morning they don't know anything about those planned talks. Marche van Ramsdonk is from the Norwegian Refugee Council's country director on the ground in Tehran. She told me how daily life has been there.
In the last 5 weeks, obviously, it has been a very surreal balance between daily life and war. I mean, people have to live. Iranians were living in those weeks. So, you know, people do go out to buy the things they need, you know, some grocery shopping, some of the Most of the shops continue to be open. Of course, shopkeepers also need to make their income during these times. But it's not like, you know, people just go in and out just very quickly and go back home. But people also still, you know, go out and have a coffee, have a chat, and then go home. So, you know, living in a war is just a very surreal reality of daily life and war. And, you know, people kind of start to get used to the sounds, start to get used to explosions, start to get used to not having access to internet, and just kind of start to organize their life under the new circumstances.
That was Marcia van Ransdorp from the Norwegian Refugee Council. Let us talk live now to Lise Doucette, the BBC's chief international correspondent, who is in Tehran. Lise, good morning to you. Tell us what people have been saying to you.
Good morning, Justin. Well, we've only just arrived in the early hours of the morning. Airports are still shut in Iran, so it means the only way to get to the capital is by road. So it's a more than 12-hour journey. But we, at the north, crossing into northwestern Iran from Turkey, we spend quite a lot of time at that crossing, and so we're able to speak to quite a big flow of Iranians coming back to their country, some saying, well, they had to come back to work, they want to be with their families. But when you ask them about the ceasefire, you really sense that the enormity of this pressure, that they just don't know whether it's going to hold or not. It's beyond their control. It's in the hands of Washington, in particular, President Trump. One man said to me, shouting, well, President Trump will never leave us alone. He wants to swallow Iran. And then others saying they were a bit scared, but they wanted to be back. And so you really feel that this is a people, you've just been hearing about them living with war. Before the war, they were living with 60% inflation. They have been living for decades under sanctions. So they really are taking it one day at a time. And as we drove, as we made this long journey by road, I found myself looking at every bridge that was still standing, because even yesterday, President Trump threatened again that he could destroy every single bridge in Iran in one day. But then he said, but I really don't want to do that. And one major bridge in the north had been destroyed by Israeli fire, which meant that we had to take a winding rural road, because it'll take some time to repair that bridge. And we could see, too, all along the highway, that there was the evidence of the damage caused by 5 weeks of strikes, the flattened bases of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, some military barracks. But we also saw factories, too, the concern that even though the U.S. and Israel kept saying, oh, we're only focusing on military targets, that civilian infrastructure also took a hit.
They've hit the military targets, Lise. Have they, from what you can see, at all shaken the ability of the authorities to impose their security on the population?
Well, it's too early for us to make a judgment about that, but certainly the reports have been consistent that even through these weeks of war, when the country was under fire, and in particular Tehran was targeted, the Basij, the paramilitary forces, were still out on the streets. They were still patrolling, still arresting. And of course, there's the reports of the executions of the protesters who had been involved in the nationwide protests in January, which had been put down with lethal force. And there was, you'll remember that at a certain point in the war, Israel in particular moved away from targeting the big military bases and went right down to street level, attacking the posts of the Basij, who are really the ones who, we saw them on our last visit, roaring on their motorcycles through the streets to send this message to Iranians, don't you dare think of coming out to protest, don't you dare make a step wrong. And we were ourselves, when we stopped to do some reporting on the road, albeit it was 2 a.m, but people came up, as they often do, no uniform, asking what we're doing, checking our identities. And President Trump keeps saying that he's brought about regime change. There's really no sign of that, and the Iranians will be the first to tell. Yes, the faces have changed, but it's still the same order. And I think these talks, if they, with first high-level face-to-face talks that took place last weekend in Islamabad with a U.S. delegation headed by J.D. Vance, they will give us the first indications of what kind of a leadership this is going to be and what they will do for their people or indeed against their people.
Because it's also been suggested, hasn't it? And again, I think this is probably going to be impossible for you to answer with any degree of certainty, but the suggestion among some critics of the war is that actually what they've ended up with now is a harder line regime than they had before it.
Certainly, if you look at the faces, the new head of the Supreme National Security Council, a hardliner among the hardliners, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, really literally calling the shots. But even before this war, when there had been years ago, when there'd been so much speculation about when the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, his health was ailing, people wondered what would follow him. It was always assumed that the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, would be playing a much more pivotal role. And now they are doing so in an even more dramatic way. So more militarized, more hardline. And yet in this, you see the person who headed, for example, the talks, Parliamentary Speaker Mohammed Bagar Ghalibaf, a former commander in the IRGC, seen as, what word to use, pragmatic, ideologically flexible, and that perhaps they could focus on something different. They feel the strength now that they can meet face to face their arch enemy and discuss the kind of issues that can hopefully, what Iranians would hope, whether or not they support the government, that the sanctions would be lifted, perhaps allow some measure of freedom. It's interesting how so many women don't wear the headscarves anymore. That's the legacy of the protests of a few years ago, the Women Life Freedom movement. So I think we really have to wait and see. But there's no doubt that while they have been fighting an external enemy, they've been keeping a tight grip on the internal enemies as well, as they would see it.
And on that subject of a tight grip, people are going to be seeing and hearing your reports in the coming days. How free are you? How free do you expect to be to go to where you want to go and to talk to who you want to talk to?
Well, you need a visa to come to Iran. It's not very difficult to get them. The BBC for many, many years was not allowed to come and report in Iran. It's always been the case that foreign journalists have to work through a media company, but we choose our own translator. We have to ask for permission to go and film in certain areas. And if you don't have the permission, you will be stopped. But it's not the kind of reporting experience that we can simply go out, set up our own interviews with families. And quite frankly, you'd think twice, because also you don't want to put people at any risk. But despite all the restriction, Justin, our last few visits have absolutely affirmed for us the importance that there's no alternative to being on the ground, meeting people face to face. And even though when you meet people on the streets and in the squares, some people say, no, I don't want to talk. No, I'll be put into prison if I talk. We really were, especially last time in the wake of those protests, the courage of people, they would push their way through the crowds and say, I want my voice to be heard. I don't care if there's any consequences for me. These have been very, very courageous people. And of course, even those who support the regime would come through the crowds and say, right, we want to tell you this. We think you're hostile to the Islamic Republic. There is value in being here on the ground, and that for us is what journalism is all about.
Lise Doucette in Tehran. Thank you.
It's 19 minutes past eight. An extraordinary story from the worlds of biology and archaeology now. In a new paper published in the journal Nature, scientists have, to a very significant degree, rewritten the recent story of human evolution. We had thought that in the past 10,000 years or so, natural selection had largely stopped, that owing to technology, agriculture, social cooperation and healthcare, we'd essentially stepped off the evolutionary treadmill. Well, it seems that is not the case. In fact, in recent millennia, natural selection has driven far more genetic variance through populations than previously thought. Dr. David Reich is one of the world's foremost geneticists. He's based at Harvard University, and he's one of the authors of the new study. And when I spoke to him a short time ago, I asked him to explain what makes this study extra special.
This is a study of of trying to use ancient DNA to learn about biological change over time. The history of ancient DNA really started in 2010 when the first DNA sequences, whole genome sequences, were obtained from human remains. And since that time, the whole field has been very transformative in terms of what it's revealed about human history. But there had always been a hope that we could also learn about biology from the DNA sequences by seeing how the frequencies of genetic mutations that change traits change over time. And for that, it's not adequate to have just one or a few samples per population. You need large numbers of samples to be able to detect subtle changes in frequency, for example, from 2% to 8%, that are the effects of natural selection driving up the frequencies of mutations. And that's only become possible in the last few years due to the large-scale production of data, and that's what our study focuses on.
How profoundly, or how big a deal is this study in profoundly changing how we think about human evolution?
The standard view before this work was that natural selection has been quiescent in our species over the last several hundred thousand years. In that, for example, the idea was that maybe 300,000 years ago, there was evolution to make early modern humans, people whose skeletons look like ours, who we start seeing appearing in the African skeletal record about 300,000 years ago. And then after that point, there's not much biological change because the species had adapted to a good way of living. And there were multiple lines of evidence for this, including some generated by my own laboratory that found that there was very little evidence of mutations going up to very high frequency since that time. But now that we have data at high resolution in large sample size from the last 18,000 years, we can see that the genome is alive with natural selection and that that paradigm is just wrong, that their selection has been continuing through this time and that it, in fact, has accelerated over this time period. This is an eventful time period in human history, one where in this part of the world, culture has changed and economies have changed dramatically. People shifted from hunting and gathering to agriculture. People began living much more densely. People began living with closely to their animals, became exposed to infectious disease, started to have different ways they spend their times. And this has profoundly shaped our genome and is continuing to shape our genome. So I think the way this is important is that it, by leveraging this vast amount of data, this single study approximately doubles the amount of data in the literature, and by developing new methods that can analyze it, we can suddenly see and appreciate this dramatic transformation that's happening in our biology and is continuing to happen in our biology.
What, for instance, have you learned about diet-related selection, diseases like celiac disease?
One of the most striking findings, we find almost 500 places in the DNA which have changed radically in frequency, too much to be due to chance. For example, we find two locations that arose around 4,000 years ago, and the mutations drove up to very substantial frequencies. They're both risk factors for celiac disease. So these two risk factors for celiac disease became much more common in the last 4,000 years. That seems surprising because this is a period of high exposure to wheat diets. You would think that perhaps people would be more tolerant, but instead people become more susceptible to gluten insensitivity to celiac disease, possibly because it protects against some kind of infection as well.
And so one of the most extraordinary things is the way you can link this ancient DNA to modern traits. And you've done so also using the UK Biobank. What kind of discoveries has that yielded?
We've been looking at the combination of genetic variants, UK Biobank, that affects, for example, obesity or the percentage of body fat or other traits. And what we can see is that the same combinations of traits for about 100 of these genetic variants, the same combination of genetic variants for about 100 of these traits have pushed in the consistent direction with natural selection over the last 10,000 years. So, for example, there's been consistent selection against genetic variants that contribute to high body fat. percentage or to high waist-to-hip ratio, which are both risk factors for type 2 diabetes. There has been consistent genetic selection against what manifests today as risk factors for smoking. Of course, smoking was not common or maybe not even occurred at all 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 years ago. But what manifests today as that risk has been pushed down in frequency.
Dr. David Wright from Harvard University, thank you so much for joining us.
And at 25 past eight, let us turn to the sport, to Mike.
Justin, thank you. For the first time in their history, Arsenal have made it to back-to-back Champions League semi-finals. A nervy 0-0 draw with Sporting Lisbon in the second leg of their quarter-final last night meant Arsenal progressed 1-0 on aggregate. They will now face Atletico Madrid in the last four. The other semi-final will see Bayern Munich face Paris Saint-Germain. After the German champions edged out Real Madrid in a seven-goal thriller last night, winning 4-3 on the night, 6-4 on aggregate. Those semi-finals will take place on the 28th and 29th of April. Before that, starting this weekend, in fact, is the World Snooker Championship up in Sheffield. And we are going to look ahead to that now in the company, I'm delighted to say, of a former world champion. Neil Robertson is with us live on the programme. Hi, Neil.
Hi there, good morning.
Very good morning to you. Thanks for being with us. So, all back to the Crucible then for the biggest 2 weeks of the year for any snooker fan and player, of course. Excitement levels must be peaking for you all right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it always gets that time of year where, you know, we're waiting for the draw to see who what names come out. And I think especially this year, there's a lot of really good young, fresh faces who have made it through the qualifying. So that's going to make it even more exciting, in my opinion.
Yeah, the draw for the World Championships taking place in about 15 minutes time, no less. Now, the rise of China, Neil, has been the big story, hasn't it, in snooker over the last 5 years or so, possibly even longer. The defending world champion, of course, is Chinese, Zhao Xintong, the first ever player from China to win the title. And four of the world's top 16 players currently are Chinese. What is behind this power shift in the global game?
Well, when China really get behind a sport, they certainly really invest into it. And, you know, it's part of the school curriculum over there. And, you know, I've had visits in China where I've gone to the schools there and I've been absolutely swarmed by hundreds of kids where, you know, if I was to do that probably over here in the UK, maybe that it wouldn't be the case. So they've really heavily backed the sport and, you know, they've got wonderful academies set up over there. And, yeah, that's the result of that. And we're seeing a lot of the younger players from China coming through. But I must say as well, there's a lot of players from mainland Europe who are coming through the game who are young players, and as well as, you know, from the UK. You know, you've got Stan Moody and Liam Pullum who have qualified. So there's a lot of excitement, not just from China, but all around the world in terms of the players that are coming through now.
Yeah, you're confident, are you, that the rest of the world can respond to this Chinese surge, the dominance that Chinese players are starting to show? You think that the rest of the world have got what it takes to keep up?
Yeah, I think the majority of the players will still come from China because of the structure that are set up there. But I think that they've shown the way in how to best produce the young talent coming through. In the UK, we don't have like a snooker club on every sort of corner, what there used to be maybe 30 years ago. So I think it needs to be done through academies and the support of you know, of councils and things like that to introduce it to younger players.
Now, we can't talk about the World Snooker Championships, from a British perspective at least, without mentioning Ronnie O'Sullivan, a player I know that you recently beat at the Saudi Arabian Masters. But how are you expecting Ronnie to fare at the Crucible? Are you expecting him to challenge?
Yeah, I think he's really keen for the eighth. I feel as though last year, if he probably didn't sort of make a change to his equipment halfway during the semi-final, I think he probably would have gone on to win an eighth world title. So yeah, he'll be really keen to do that. Nobody's really too sure what his form is like. I know he got to the final of the World Open, but he didn't play in the Tour Championship. So, yeah, like always with Ronnie, we're kind of like we're waiting on the edge of our seats to sort of see what happens.
And I want to get your perspective as well on the news that we heard a few weeks ago now from Barry Hearn, former boss of World Snooker, that the championships are staying in Sheffield, not just for the short to medium term, but for the next 20 years. Long-term deal agreed to keep the World Championships at the Crucible after several years of talk of it potentially moving to China or maybe the Middle East. What's the players' perspective of this prestigious tournament staying in Sheffield?
Yeah, all the players are delighted with it. You know, the idea came through with Barry that he wanted to expand the Crucible to make it bigger, more seating, and you know, better hospitality, better for the players behind the scenes. You know, obviously you don't get to see that on TV, but it is pretty cramped behind the scenes. And yeah, so this is wonderful news. Obviously, great for Sheffield as well, because you know, the World Championships is, you know, it's a great place to be around Sheffield over those 2.5 weeks. And yeah, I think it's a massive win for everybody. You know, I remember speaking to a player last year about whether, you know, someone who hadn't qualified for the Crucible, and he said that he'd be devastated if he qualified for the World Championships and it wasn't at the Crucible. So I'm really pleased that we've been able to hold on to that really precious history of the sport.
And just very finally, Neil, I just want to mention as well, this will be the first World Championships without the great John Virgo, the former player turned commentator, of course, died sadly earlier this year. I know you're going to a memorial service in memory of John later today. How much will he be missed at these World Championships?
Yeah, very much so. Sadly, over the last few years, we've lost you know, some huge names in our sport who have been you know, a big part of the history, like, you know, Clive Everton, Ray Reardon, and Terry Griffiths passing away, as well as Willie Thorne. So yeah, I mean, I had the privilege of working with John in the commentary box a couple of years ago, and you really got a great appreciation for just how good he was. He could make every frame seem really intense and draw the viewers in, and yeah, he'll be sadly missed.
Neil Robertson, former world snooker champion, many thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. The World Championship's getting underway on Saturday. Should say the draw, though, for the championship is just moments away, 8:45. You can watch that live on the BBC Sport website and iPlayer. And this programme will be live at the Crucible on Saturday morning. My first visit to the World Snooker Championships. Really looking forward to that. And we'll be there live Saturday morning.
Mike, thank you. In our time, coming up after the news at 9, here is Misha Glennie to tell us more.
Good morning. We'll be discussing M.C. Escher. Escher's known best for his artworks of impossible buildings, mind-boggling twists of perspective, and never-ending staircases. He's been celebrated by mathematicians for his precise, intuitive understanding of geometry. Escher also caught the attention of cognitive scientist Douglas Hofstadter, investigating consciousness and strange loops, cyclical structures that, as you follow them, mysteriously leave you back where you started. That's M.C. Escher with guests Marcus de Sotoy, Sarah Hart and Judith Cadet on In Our Time on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds just after 9 a.m.
Thank you very much indeed, Misha. 27 minutes to 9. I think we've clarified the weather. So, this morning, variable crowds, Justin, but also this morning, variable cloud across the UK with showers in northern Scotland, but later it's going to turn darker with some light rain in the south and Northern Ireland. Does that make sense?
Kind of. You're listening to Today on Radio 4, the weather forecaster, I'm Amaraj, and Justin Webb. It is 27 minutes to 9. Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
A BBC investigation has found further abuse of the asylum system, with some migrants falsely claiming to be victims of domestic violence in order to stay in the UK. They're exploiting rules brought in to protect genuine survivors and to be fast-tracked to residency. The Secretary of State for Business and Trade, Peter Kyle, told us he hoped people who abused the asylum system were prosecuted. Ukraine says 16 people have been killed by overnight Russian missile strikes across the country. 4 people, including a 12-year-old boy, died in the capital, Kyiv. The UK economy grew by 0.5% in February, according to new figures from the Office for National Statistics. A previous estimate of no growth in January has been revised up to 0.1%. The data does not show the impact of the Iran war, which began on the last day of February. Senior social media executives have been summoned to Downing Street for a meeting today where they'll be challenged about the action they're taking to protect children. Sir Keir Starmer is expected to say looking the other way is not an option.
Thank you for that. 26 minutes to 9 is the time. We revealed yesterday that asylum seekers are being encouraged to claim to be gay in order to be granted the right to stay here. This morning we've been hearing that migrants are falsely claiming to be victims of domestic abuse in order to stay in the country. Ministers, we heard one earlier, say it's unacceptable. Anyone abusing the system will be in trouble. Others say the system itself doesn't work, needs to be overhauled. The Conservatives, Lib Dems and the Greens have all condemned what is shown by our investigation, and the Conservatives are saying all of it needs to change. Let us talk to Zia Yusuf, Reforms Home Affairs spokesman, who is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you say about what we revealed yesterday and also this morning?
But look, it's obviously shocking that the British people are being defrauded on an industrial scale, not just by hundreds of thousands of illegal migrants showing up in this country, but by basically an industrial complex of lawyers and advisors who are actively coaching illegal migrants and visa overstayers to, for example, as the BBC has revealed, for example, claim that they have been victims of domestic abuse when they haven't, or claim to be gay or lesbian when they haven't. And I would ask, how many arrests have been made as a result of the BBC investigation? Have the police come out and said that they are actively investigating? Look, reform are going to change all of this. Number one, we will introduce a criminal offence of abetting a fraudulent asylum claim. And that will be something called a strict liability offence, meaning the prosecutor will not have to prove intent. So it'll be just like the financial crime laws that law firms are already subject to.
But surely number it's two, already an offence, isn't it? Hang on, we'll get on to number two.
Point, and well, I'll make one other point. The second thing we will do, which is really important, we will end legal aid being given, taxpayer-funded legal fees being handed to people who come here illegally or come on a different visa and then claim asylum. That's £135 million since 2018 has been spent on that. We've got to do that too. We will put an end to the British taxpayer being taken for mugs and this kind of industrial-scale fraud.
Right. So on the first of those points, plainly, if you're breaking the law, you're breaking the law. You're already breaking the law. If you're encouraging someone to tell lies and you're a solicitor, for instance, that is not legal.
No, so Section 25 of the Immigration Act does exist. And if you were to read that, you might think that everything you saw in that documentary, you know, arrests would have been made swiftly. The problem is the prosecutor must prove intent. And so therefore, the burden is on the prosecutor to prove that. We've got to change that to ensure that people are actively prosecuted. Therefore, not only are charge rates extremely low, you know, we've only seen around 400 actual prosecutions on this, when clearly the problem is much, much bigger than that. So we will introduce a law much more similar. It'll be strict liability, which basically means it's just like the financial crime laws that law firms are already and accountants are already liable to. You know, if an accountant or a law firm helps somebody commit tax fraud, for example, they are liable for that, and the prosecutor does not need to prove intent. And as a result of that, we will create a proper deterrent. Stop. Number one, the sort of things you saw in that program will result in people going to jail, quite rightly. And number two, it will create a proper deterrent so that this legal industrial complex, which, as I said, is defrauding the British people on an industrial scale, will end under a reform government.
Under a reform government, would anyone be allowed to come here and say, I'm gay and I fear persecution in the country I've come for, and for that reason I should stay, and they'd be allowed to?
No, that would not be. If you've come here illegally, you will never be allowed to stay in this country.
Well,
if you
on,
come
so
here
what
on a visitor
you...
visa or a student visa and then overstay and then try and claim asylum, you will never be allowed to stay
what
in this
you,
country.
What we if you claim, hang on a second, what that. If you claim asylum legally and you do it presumably abroad, which would be your scheme, and you make that claim, can a claim, I need asylum because I'm gay or because I am an atheist or for any of those beliefs or identities, can a claim under those circumstances when reform is in power work?
Look, this country has been overwhelmed with illegal immigration. Britain has done more than its fair share in terms of asylum. We need a moratorium on all of this for a significant period of time.
All
but
of
I
it.
Want to make a really important
but no,
point.
No, hang on. Just to be absolutely clear on this. Under reform, you would not have evidence provided that someone could be persecuted because they were gay in a country as a legitimate reason to be granted asylum, ever.
Do you think it's appropriate? How many people on the planet, tragically, are legitimately in danger as a result to being gay? The number is in the hundreds of millions. It would multiply the population of the United Kingdom if we were to have such a policy. But I put it to you that your question completely betrays the fundamental point here, that the people lying about this stuff, lying about appalling things like domestic abuse, ruining other people's lives, lying about the fact that they're gay when they are not and they are not in danger, actually harms the people you're talking about just as much. But I want to be crystal clear about this. We make no apologies. Britain has been overwhelmed with illegal immigration. Britain has been overwhelmed with regards to asylum. Our systems, our national infrastructure is buckling. British people have had quite enough of it. There needs to be a moratorium for a good number of years until, for example, you've deported the people who shouldn't be in the country in the first place.
Do you believe that the British people, when they think about themselves in the round, as kindly, as outward-looking, etc., are ready for the kind of change then that you are proposing this morning?
Well, all I can do is look at the evidence for that. I mean, there's been a lot of polling, for example, on whether British people think that everyone in the country illegally should be deported. And that is a overwhelmingly popular position. In fact, YouGov had that north of, I think, 60%.
That's a little bit different,
though, isn't it? Want that. So my view is absolutely. And if you were to ask the British people, do they think British citizens should have priority access to, for example, our NHS? And do they think, for example, that British citizens should have exclusive access to things like our welfare state? Those are also very popular positions. But again, what you've seen in this documentary is that very goodwill, that incredible goodwill that British people have. They are the loveliest, kindest people in the world. I believe that to be true. But it has been massively taken advantage of. And it is simply unacceptable for British political leaders, starting with the Tories and now Labour continuing it, to allow the lovely British people to be taken advantage of in that way. And that is what we will stop.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Ukraine, where the reported death toll has risen to 16 in attacks from Russia. 9 people have been confirmed dead in Odessa alone. President Zelensky has posted a statement calling for more pressure on Russia. He says there can be no normalization of Russia as it is today. Pressure on Russia must work. And of course, this comes at a time when there's tremendous scrutiny of America's relationship with Ukraine and Russia, and indeed whether its support for Ukraine is as steadfast as it had previously been. Let's speak to Sarah Rainsford, who is in Kyiv for us. Sarah, just tell us what's happened overnight, would you?
Yeah, it was a very disturbed and a very deadly night here in Kyiv and across Ukraine last night. We were woken around about 2:30 in the morning by the air raid sirens, and then we started to hear the very loud explosions here in central Kyiv. We know now that there were a number of residential buildings were hit, whether directly, as we saw one video of a Shahed drone slamming straight into the side of a residential building, or whether it was fragments when Ukraine shot down ballistic missiles and shot down drones, and then those fragments landed on buildings below. But either way, we know that a 12-year-old boy was killed here in Kyiv. We know another child was pulled out of the rubble of their home, and we know that 9 people, as you say, were killed in Odessa, the port city, which obviously, you know, Russia's striking the port infrastructure there, trying to cripple Ukraine's economy. But as a result of that, residential buildings have been hit, and there's a huge amount of damage there too. And, you know, as I say, one of the deadliest nights for some time here in Ukraine.
President Zelensky, this ongoing wartime leader, has been touring European capitals, hasn't he, to try to keep support going. Where is President Zelensky's sort of international support at the moment? Is it as steadfast as before? Or frankly, with the Iran conflict escalating, is there a sort of a worry in Ukraine that the support that Ukraine says it wants and needs is not going to become, you know, forthcoming?
I think there is a worry, definitely. I think it's a kind of mixed picture. I think Europe is strong in its support. And I think particularly the defeat of Viktor Orban has been a bit of a boost for Ukraine, hoping that Hungary will now no longer block massive financial support, economic support from the EU to Ukraine, and also military support too going forward. But of course, the relationship with the United States is very complicated. And, you know, the two US envoys that Donald Trump appointed to mediate between Moscow and Ukraine have never been to Kyiv. We've been hearing recently that they have postponed visits several times lately. President Zelensky most recently said that they had agreed that they would come, but there's still no date for that. And meanwhile, those relentless attacks continue. And just talking to people here, I've been here for the past nearly 3 weeks now. You know, there is this exhaustion with this war. Nobody wants to give up. They're still steadfastly defending themselves, but they do see that, you know, the international picture is getting tougher. It's getting tougher to ask for help. And so the kind of converse of that is that Ukraine has been presenting itself recently to the world as a supplier of expertise and of drone technology, which the war in the Middle East, I think, has shown Ukraine has something to offer on that. So in a way, there's a bit of a kind of a reversal of things. Ukraine saying its terrible experience here has at least given it something it can offer. And the money from those drone sales will potentially go to helping Ukraine defend itself and not having to always be holding out the begging bowl.
Sarah Rainsford, thank you so much.
The time, 16 minutes to 9. Social media leaders call to Downing Street over children's safety. That is the big headline this morning. It sounds rather performative. What is the reality of what's going on behind the scenes? Let's talk to Victoria Baines, who's Professor Emerita of IT at Gresham College in London, and previously, quite a few years ago, a decade or so ago, worked for Facebook. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
What do you make of what's happening today? So they're being called in, but we don't actually know who they are, do we? Presumably isn't Elon Musk for X, and isn't the bosses of the other ones as well. Do you know anything more about what's actually going on?
We tend to find that Elon is quite busy on these kinds of calls. I think your assessment of this as performative is quite important, because what we've seen is the Prime Minister and the government being under pressure to implement a ban from social media for under 16s. And what we've seen in Australia is that ban has been quite performative in itself. It's been a political moment rather than something that's been particularly easy to achieve operationally. So in Australia, we've seen that although millions of accounts have been taken down for under 16s, young people are still reporting that they can access social media. And this points to the challenges of really operationalizing that kind of ban. So my take on what's happening today is that the Prime Minister is calling in these tech executives, and I've been one of these executives in the past, to assure him that the requirements of the Online Safety Act that came in a couple of years ago, that they really are doing what's being required of them.
Which is what?
There are a number of things. Certainly making sure that children don't have access to illegal content, that, for instance, child abuse material, terrorist content is certainly not being circulated on their platforms, that they're not having access to adult content like pornography. But there's another level here, which is really thinking about recommendation engines, how social media platforms work. What do they do? They try and keep us on the platform. They're what they like to call sticky, because they autoplay videos. They keep us continuously scrolling. And that appears to be one of the things that the Prime Minister is going to want assurances about. How do we stop children being glued to their screens?
But I mean, that is
harmful for them.
To put it bluntly, and you'll know this as an insider as well, that's the business model. And
absolutely, it is.
How much, realistically, how much hope has the government got, indeed as the Prime Minister got, of saying to these companies, number one, make your algorithms public, which is one of the suggestions, isn't it? But number two, that we somehow have some power over what you do with them.
That is the sticking point, I think. And we're at a difficult point in time where the Online Safety Act has been in force for a couple of years. The regulator, Ofcom, has been accused of dragging its heels a little bit in terms of monitoring and enforcement, especially when we're seeing bans in other countries. But ultimately, it's on the companies as well as the government to make sure that if online environments are open to children, they are protected from harm as far as reasonably possible.
What if they bang the drum and really say, look, the alternative to you doing what we want you to do is massive fines, whatever. Do you get the impression at all? And you think of that court case that's been recently in Los Angeles, etc., that the social media companies feel themselves to be under more pressure than they used to feel themselves to be under?
There would have been a time when I would have said to you, particularly in, you know, the scope of data protection and the introduction of GDPR in 2018, when I would have said to you, oh, these companies just see fines as part of their business model. It's just part of, you know, the costs that they have to incur. I think that court case in the US is a turning point in terms of how companies may now perceive their liability in this space, that now they are being held responsible by courts of law, albeit in the US in a civil capacity, for the harms that their users incur. And I think we're going to see, you know, many, many more of these lawsuits, certainly in the US. But I think there is perhaps a recognition that this is not something that an anodyne press statement will dispense with.
Victoria Baines, Professor Emerita of IT at Gresham College in London. Thank you very much.
11 minutes to nine. How many of you are lesser siblings? Relative failures, if you like, forever living in the long shadows of our charmingly gorgeous and brilliant brother or sister. In a new book called Relative Failures, the historian and biographer Matthew Sturgis tells three stories of relative failures, lesser siblings. There's Oscar Wilde's hapless brother, Willie. Who remembers him? There's Aubrey Beardsley's sister, Mabel. Remember her? And Howard Sturgis, Sturgis, less well-known brother of Victorian novelist Julian Sturgis and great-uncle of Matthew himself, who joins us now in the studio along with Catherine Carr, broadcaster, host of the Relatively podcast and author of the slightly sort of terrifyingly named Who's the Favourite? The Loving, Messy Realities of Sibling Relationships. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Oh, good morning.
Matthew, is this basically autobiographical? Are you a lesser sibling? Is this why you've got this off your
chest? Well, I do have four conspicuously successful siblings, but so there was an element of, I don't know, projection in it, possibly.
You're well known as a very distinguished historian. Why did you want to turn your attention to these lesser-known siblings in history?
Well, I'd written biographies of Oscar Wilde most recently, and before that Aubrey Beardsley, and while researching them had been very struck by their siblings, who of course had appeared in the story as I was researching them, and they were sort of rivers, tributaries that I couldn't follow at the time to their full extent, but clearly these were very interesting people in their way, and also they reflected on the lives of their more successful siblings. I mean, they had a shared genetic inheritance, basically, and certainly the same upbringing. And yet, well, conspicuously in Willie Wilde's case, he took his great gifts and really, I suppose you'd have to say, frittered them away. I mean, as young boys and indeed young men, there was much debate amongst their contemporaries as to who was the most brilliant, Willie or Oscar. He was charming, witty, he was slightly taller than Oscar, yes, many people sort of imagined he might have the stellar career.
And he might write the picture of Dorian Gray, but he didn't. Catherine, you spent many years speaking to siblings. Is it sort of inevitable that there'll be A, a feeling of rivalry, and B, therefore, a feeling of inferiority?
I don't know if it's inevitable, because siblings, as well as being rivals, can be social models and inspirational, really. They're foundational, these relationships. And I would...
Can they?
Yes! I would disagree slightly with Martin that we don't have the same upbringing, and that's the whole point. We don't share an environment, we don't share a childhood with our siblings, even though we're together. We have totally different experiences and memories of our childhood. And because of how the things have changed in between the children being born, we can't compare like with like. And also, I think, to your point about your book, there is an idea of differentiation among siblings. Once one role is taken, children seem to subconsciously understand that they must find another to have a USP and get some parental
and
attention.
To what extent is that owing to birth order? Malcolm Gladwell and others have looked at successful children, and there's this annoying thing that it's often the firstborn who get the devotion of the parents and the resources, and if parents have had lots of children, by the time they get to the second or third, they're knackered and they sort of can't be bothered.
I think you're knackered with the first as well.
Tell me about it.
I think there was an interesting study from MIT that showed something I hadn't thought of, which is if you're the first, yes, you get the resources to begin with. But also, if you have parental leave for the subsequent children, you get various bites of the cherry as the eldest. You might get 2, 3, or 4 maternity or paternity leaves. That said, it's highly cultural. In other parts of the world, the firstborn doesn't end up being quote-unquote cleverer because of an increase in resources. They might be sent out to work in order to put money in the family's coffers. So it's birth order and then what cultural expectations come along with it.
Matthew, in your experience, is there a sort of what Freud called the narcissism of small difference? In other words, it's useful if you've got a highly capable sibling to avoid doing the same thing. You think of Jamie Murray, who's I think just retired this week as Andy Murray's brother, absolutely astonishingly brilliant tennis player, but he's forever Jamie Murray and not Andy Murray. And similarly with Willie Wilde, I mean, maybe if he'd rather than being a fantastic writer, if he'd been a portrait artist or done something completely different, he'd have been better off.
Yes, I mean, Willie was the elder brother of the two, but yes, just about 18 months older, and he began with literary ambitions. He published poems before Oscar did. But then Oscar's sort of star began to rise, and he very much, Catherine hinted at, felt that he should cede that position being the main focus to Oscar. And he became a sort of helper, a sort of handmaiden to Oscar's fame.
That must have been hellishly hard.
Well, no, he liked it. It gave him a sort of power. He went into journalism. He abandoned a career in the law for the sort of more immediate rewards and delights of journalism. And I came to London at a moment when the whole sort of press world was just expanding rapidly. There were, you know, dozens of evening newspapers, magazines, or whatever, periodicals. And he, with his, you know, facile wit and ready pen, sort of was brilliant at it. And part of his brilliance was seeding these little references to Oscar and the amusing things that Oscar had said in the press. And he took a pleasure and I think felt a certain sort of, you know, sort of power and relevance in aiding his brother.
He sounds like a great guy and not like any older brother I've ever come across.
But then, of course, he did come to resent it later.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I mean, that's the trouble. That,
well, they'll get to that at the end of your book. Matthew Sturgis, author of Relative Failures, and Catherine Carr, host of the Relatively podcast and author of Who's the Favourite? The Loving Messy Realities of Sibling Relationships. Thank you both very much indeed.
And at 4 minutes to nine, just time to say, if you're after some meditative music this morning over on Radio 3, just now, the star violinist Janine Jansen is going to be playing the Brahms Violin Concerto. But don't go quite yet, because...
because, in a different form of meditation, we're going to end the programme by contemplating galaxies. Thanks to something called the DESI, the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument. Is that right, Professor?
Right.
And its 5-year survey of the sky at night from an observatory in Arizona, we will soon have, as a species, the most intricate 3D map of the universe that we have ever had. This map features a mere 47 million galaxies.
Correct.
and quasars, which obviously are galactic nuclei, which have supermassive black holes at their centre. And one hope is that this map is going to help us better understand dark energy, the force responsible for the expansion of the universe. And to explain what all of this means, with us in the studio is Professor Ofer Lahav, the Perrin Chair of Astronomy at University College London. Professor, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Have I got any of that correct at all?
Just very precise.
Wonderful. What is this map going to tell us and tell you?
Yeah, so there are billions of galaxies in the universe. This is a sample of 47 million, only 47 million, but we are very pleased about it. When I was a student back in Cambridge 40 years ago, we had a sample of thousands, and now our students have to cope with these huge samples and think how to analyze them using AI and other techniques. Why are we doing it? Well, it's part of human curiosity, first, just to map the world. You know, we explored, we went to see, to discover new continents. We'd like to know, where do we live? So that's point number one. Point number two is by getting a three-dimensional map. We have a position on the sky, and we have the distance using redshift, that's due to the expansion of the universe. And then we can use it to actually learn about the physics of the universe. It seems we live in a rather strange universe at present, that only 5% of it is made of ordinary matter, 25% of it of an unknown cold dark matter, and 70% dark energy.
What is dark energy?
So what is dark energy? The concept goes back to Einstein.
1917.
Very good. Where he basically hypothesized a constant, which he called the cosmological constant, labeled it with the Greek letter lambda. And then he introduced it for a particular reason. He wanted the static universe, turned out to be the universe is expanding. So he said it was the blunder of his life. So he just abandoned it. That no longer. And, you know, when I was brought up as a student, you know, it was believed to be zero. And then about 25 years ago, there was a sort of paradigm shift, as we call it, and measuring supernovae, their luminosity with distance, people realize, wow, there is a cosmological constant, but it generates an acceleration of the universe. So what's happening now with this DESI, which I should say, it's a huge effort. 900 people are involved, many laboratories, contribution from the UK to the optics, Durham and UCL, my university, built some of it.
Briefly, we've only got 10 seconds. Tell us, what's the big thing you're hoping?